read it, say a word or two?
I will. Oh, there, it wasn't there a minute ago, so.
I see.
Yeah.
So.
They'll set it up for you.
It's already on, so you'll just push this to go.
Forward, okay.
Great.
And you've got. I don't see. Well, good evening. Thank you for coming out to our city council meeting. We've just returned from a closed session, so I'll ask our city attorney to report on any items that we can.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. On the agenda tonight, as consent item number five, is the proposed approval of agreements for compensation with four of the five employee units in the city, not including the firefighters union. On October 21 of 2015, the city received a notice from the Firefighters Union initiating the impasse procedures set forth in the city's rules. The city intends to continue to follow the city's rules in good faith. And that's the end of the report.
Thank you. We'll begin with calling the regular session to order and beginning with our Pledge of Allegiance by Councilwoman Fonzie. Thank you. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Fonzie?
Here.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Here.
Councilmember Kelly?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Moreno?
Here.
Mayor O'Malley?
Here.
All present.
Thank you. First item is the approval of the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
I have a motion by Councilman Sturdivant, seconded by Councilman Kelly. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Councilmember Fonzie?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Moreno?
Yes.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Thank you. Well, we get to begin with four presentations tonight. We're always honored to have so much going on in our community. What we're going to do is have a different council member read each presentation. We'll hear from the folks receiving that. And then after we get through all four presentations, we're going to take a little break and then rotate those four groups through one at a time so we can be sure Luke gets a good picture for Atascadero News of each organization represented here tonight. We're privileged to begin with the presentation by Estrella Warbirds, and we're going to have Roberta Fonzi, a military family mom and wife, make this presentation.
Thank you, Mayor. It's my honor to do this in the time that we have for Veterans Day and Armed Forces Day in November. And this is a proclamation recognizing the Estrella Warbirds Museum and the Freedom Flight. Whereas the Estrella Warbirds Museum is dedicated to the men and women who are serving, who have served, and to those who have sacrificed their life while in the military, and is dedicated to the restoration and preservation of military aircraft and military vehicles and memorabilia, not to glorify conflict, but rather to help make future generations aware that freedom and our way of life does not come without sacrifice. And whereas the Estrella Warbirds Museum was founded over 20 years ago with the primary goal to preserve, perpetuate, and display American aviation history, especially that of our nation's military services. And whereas the Estrella Warbirds Museum honors the past while inspiring current and future generations and houses a truly one-of-a-kind collection of aircraft and air artifacts from airplanes which made aviation history to piles of parts repurposed as fully restored vintage aircraft from Jeeps, antique ambulances, and early year aircraft to fighter jets recently retired from active duty. From sidearms and unique personal items carried in combat during the previous century to one of the earliest pilot licenses issued by the FAA. And whereas through the efforts of George Merritt and the cooperation of the Estrella Warbirds Museum and specifically Freedom Flight, the City of Atascadero's September 11, 2015 Patriots Day celebration ceremony and public lighting of City Hall was made an extraordinarily special and memorable event with the flyover of a three-ship Warbird formation led by Frank Owen, Mac Glenn, and left-wing piloted by George Merritt. Whereas through the efforts of Jerry Takier, president of the board, the Estrella Warbirds Museum provided two World War II-era military vehicles for display in front of historic City Hall throughout the September 11, 2015 event, allowing members of the public to better appreciate the evening and the event for which it was intended to be, an evening of recognition and honor of all the men and women in active or former service to their community and country, whether police, fire, or military. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the City Council of the City of Atascadero that we recognize the extraordinary efforts and service of the Estrella Warbirds Museum and Freedom Flight to the men and women of the military, the community, and the City of Atascadero. Thank you.
Please come forward. I know you have a few words to share, and we welcome you at the lectern.
Good evening, Mayor Malley, City Council, and members of the community. I'm Dr. Mike Levine. I'm the Public Information Officer and a member of the board of the Estrella Warbirds Museum, and I'm honored to be here tonight to accept this proclamation for the museum members and for Mr. Jerry Takier, who was unable to attend. I was asked to prepare just a few comments about the museum. Is that okay if I do that
yes.
now?
Yes.
Okay. I did not memorize them. As you just heard, the museum's been in existence for more than 20 years. It's come a long way over the past 23 years, in fact. It's grown from one building, our main hangar, which started life as a former almond warehouse, to 10 buildings spread over 12 acres with military aircraft, ground vehicles, armament, and other military memorabilia worth over $4 million. There are close to 600 members of the museum. As a nonprofit 501c3 corporation, we rely on our volunteer pool for just about everything. We serve as docents and gift shop workers. We restore aircraft and ground vehicles. We operate our F-18 flight simulator, keep up the appearance of the museum, and we even serve on the board of directors. Volunteers essentially do everything required for the museum to function. And we are always looking for new volunteers. Some of our current helpers regularly travel from as far away as Arroyo Grande, Los Osos, Lockwood, just to mention a few of the communities, to lend a hand at the museum doing something they love to do, and they do it on a regular basis. It's been our good fortune in the past to have had very generous donors and sponsors for museum operations, for our annual events, for growth of our campus, and for acquisition of displays. buildings have been erected and exhibits have been expanded, all because of this generosity. In fact, in September, on September 17th, we dedicated two new buildings, the fourth Woodland Auto Display expansion and a brand new addition to the museum donated by Mr. Herman Fowder of Santa Barbara, called the Red Ball Express Building. It houses his collection of World War II trucks that were responsible for resupplying General Patton's tank force as it rapidly moved across Europe, and that was very crucial in defeating Nazi Germany. Our future plans are to increase the size of the museum complex with the addition of approximately 10 more acres, and our building plan has already been submitted to the city of Paso Robles. Once we get the approval to lease the adjacent space, our goal is to build larger hangars to display historic aircraft. This will allow us to expand the museum's buildings, our holdings, to include additional exhibition displays. We are very proud of the museum, which is a great asset to the Central Coast communities. Here are just a few facts. The Australia Warbirds Museum and Woodland Auto Display has been rated number one on the TripAdvisor website as the top thing to see and do in Paso Robles. Our guests have included visitors from all 50 states and 43 countries. For the past 7 years, we've held the Warbirds Wing and Wheels Car Show on one day each May, with over 250 classic automobiles on display spread throughout our campus. There were over 3,500 visitors enjoying the museum without any charge each year on that day. In recent years, we held a Warbirds Over Paso air show that filled the skies with historic aircraft from the Planes of Fame Museum in Chino, California. It's our fervent hope that we will be able to hold the air show again next year. As you know, members of the museum like George Merritt, who is here with me tonight, have flown their aircraft in formation over the Central Coast communities for many years, including recently at Atascadero, as you've acknowledged. For many years, they've done this for national holidays and during funeral services to honor those who served in the military. In addition, many of our rolling stock of military vehicles have also been used in parades also, as you know, on display in our communities. And we are always looking for ways to help communities with our exhibits. Again, I want to thank you for inviting us to be here tonight. If you haven't been to the Australia Warbirds Museum and Woodland Auto Display, or it's been quite a while since you've been there, please put it in your calendar of things to do. You'll be very happy that you did. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you all for your service in our community. Next proclamation.
Tom, can I just make a comment?
Sure. We will be having them cycle back.
I'd just like to take this minute and recognize George Merritt there in the back. For years, I've heard his name flying over town with another infamous Bob Kelly, and everybody says, how do you do that? And I says, I can't tell you. It's a mystery. Some time ago, I got to talk to George at the dedication of the Charles Paddock Zoo. Had quite a conversation with him, and he has written a book called Cheating Death. We're honored. He's a true American hero. He flew over 180 missions in Vietnam in Sky Raiders, rescuing or helping to rescue downed pilots. If you get a chance to read the book, you can't put it down. And George, I just want to thank you for the service that you made to our country. It was unbelievable. I know you lost a lot of friends and what have you, but thank you very much.
And we'll get back together here very soon. Next item is a proclamation recognizing some heroic actions, and Councilman Kelly is going to read this proclamation.
Thank you. We're lucky. We have a couple of heroes here tonight. Last May, I read an article in the newspaper about a gentleman from Atascadero who was down in Ventura on the beach and noticed somebody in distress in the water and went in and rescued him. And they declare that Mr. Tarwider actually saved the boy's life. Some of the rescue people said they wouldn't recommend people doing that because of the dangerous conditions. And Boyd was in the Navy and he has some experience at CPR. And they say he's responsible for that person being alive today. At the time, I thought we should recognize Mr. Tarwider. And shame on me, went on vacation and it kind of overpassed. But here a couple weeks ago, I was down getting my monthly city briefing at Woody's Old Time Barbershop, finding out what's really going on in town. And I got to meet Boyd, talk to him a little bit, and I said, we need to recognize Boyd for what he has done. and where he's come from and where he's going in the future. So I'd like to read this proclamation. Whereas Mr. Boyd Tarwater is a resident of Atascadero, and whereas while enjoying an afternoon picnic with friends on Ventura Beach in May of 2015, Mr. Tarwater saw that someone was struggling in the water and was caught in a dangerous rip current. And whereas Mr. Tarwater, without regard for his personal safety and well-being, jumped into the water to save the man. And whereas Mr. Tarwater single-handedly pulled the young man back to shore. And whereas the swimmer required attendance by emergency responders who then transported him to a nearby hospital. And whereas Ventura public officials stated that Mr. Tarwater likely saved the young man's life. And whereas Mr. Boyd Tarwater was the right person in the right place at the right time. Now, therefore, the City Council of the City of Atascadero hereby proclaims that Boyd Tarwater is a good citizen of Atascadero who is well deserving of honor and recognition from the Council and from the citizens of the City of Atascadero for his heroic actions, which resulted in saving the life of another individual. Thank you, Boyd. Would you like to?
Thank you very much. I still am under the impression that I really didn't do anything special. Okay, I happened to be there. Somebody needed help. I was able to help, and that's just what I would hope anybody would do. I mean, as you said, I have a terrible past. Okay, I've spent 23 years of my life locked up behind bars due to drug and alcohol problems. I paroled from CMC 2.5 years ago and decided to come up here instead of going back to Ventura because I knew if I wanted to stay clean that I had to change everything. So I came up here and started going to school at Cuesta. I'm now in my third year there. I'm working on associates in family studies with a certain drug and alcohol. I'm blessed to have a job as an intern counselor right over here at Central Coast Freedom Center, where we started an adolescent program, and I get to work with the adults. I do what I can in this community because there is a bad drug problem. I started here at the Griffin Society at Gate Help Inc. I'm blessed to be able to spend time with the man that started all that on pretty much almost a daily basis, and he's like my mentor. He teaches me what needs to be done, and my higher power makes sure that I can do what needs to be done, and that's just the way I live today.
Well, we thank you, and we admire you for your efforts in turning your life around.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, it's my honor to offer the next proclamation to RISE, recognizing October as Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And I will go through this proclamation and invite you up to share a few words as well. Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Whereas domestic violence continues to be a major national public health problem affecting one in three women, with an estimated 10 million children witnessing domestic violence in their homes each year. And whereas 92% of women surveyed listed reducing domestic violence and sexual assault as their top concern. And whereas RISE continues to provide a safe environment to those affected by domestic violence with crisis intervention, counseling, education, legal services, and emergency safe housing with the help of dedicated volunteers and professionals. And whereas RISE has provided services to more than 700 domestic violence clients in this last year, including more than 5,000 collective nights provided for shelter clients, and more than 16,000 meals. And whereas as the City of Atascadero strongly supports the efforts of RISE, how every segment of our society can work together to better address intimate partner violence and how to help survivors connect with services. Now, therefore, the City Council of the City of Atascadero, in recognition of the important work done by domestic violence programs, does hereby proclaim the month of October to be National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And thank you, Jen. Please share a few words.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Adams. I'm the executive director of RISE. And your story brought tears to my eyes, so thank you so much. We rode up in the elevator together. I didn't know I was in the presence of a hero. That was lovely. So thank you on behalf of the staff, volunteers, and board of directors of RISE. We were created about 3 years ago with the merger of the North County Women's Shelter and the Sexual Assault Recovery and Prevention Center. It's been just over 2 years since we became RISE San Luis Obispo County, and during that time, we continue to work to meet the needs of survivors in our community. RISE just celebrated a new step in increasing awareness about the amazing work of our organization by hosting the inaugural Wine, Women, and Shoes event in Santa Margarita on September 12th. And we have pictures, which I was so excited. Thank you for putting them up. And if we could roll through, we can see some familiar faces in here of some community members that were very active in helping us, including Mayor Pro Tem Moreno. Look at her. Is she awesome or what?
Wow.
She was on the runway, and she looked like she was born to walk that walk. It was awesome. And then I think the next, yep, there's our soul men, and Council Member Sturtevant is a part of that as well. So we are so appreciative of your participation, and Mayor O'Malley was going to be there and had to drop out at the last moment, but we just really appreciate your presence and the great work that you did there, and we hope to see you again next year. And then on top of that, we want to also recognize Mayor O'Malley and Martin. He just told me right before he was going to host the Mother's Day brunch again for to benefit RISE and the women and children there. So we really appreciate that and look forward to that event in May. With that, I want to introduce our board member, Charles Bourbeau, to just say a word. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Jenny and Mayor and members of the council. I want to say a special thank you to all of you, because not only does the council support RISE through its proclamation, each of you has individually done things that Jenny described, and it shows the kind of community spirit that each of you has. And along those lines, I wanted to point out that even though RISE does have some paid staff, a huge amount of the work done by RISE for the community is done with volunteers, and in keeping with our Colony Day spirit of honoring volunteers, we have over 40 volunteers that handle the 24-hour crisis line and provide a lot of other great services that are really needed in our community. And so just thank you again for your recognition, and she won't toot her own horn, but she just does an amazing job for the organization and for the community. Thank you.
Yes, she does. Thank you. Our next presentation will be regarding civil discourse presentation by the League of Women Voters, and we'll have Ms. Heather Moreno read this.
Thank you, Mayor. It's a proclamation to promote the use of principles of civility and civil discourse in conducting business with elected officials, staff, and citizens. Whereas the Atascadero City Council, in order to ensure civility and civil discourse in all of their meetings, pledges commitment to the following best practices of civility and civil discourse. Respect the right of all people to hold different opinions. Avoid rhetoric intended to humiliate, malign, or question the motivation of those whose opinions are different from ours. Strive to understand differing perspectives. Choose words carefully. Speak truthfully without accusation and avoid distortion. Speak out against violence, prejudice, incivility, and all of their forms whenever and wherever they occur. Whereas we commit ourselves to building a civil political community in which each person is respected, and spirited public and political debate is aimed at the betterment of the city of Atascadero and its people, and not the disparagement of those with whom we disagree. And whereas the City Council of the City of Atascadero has previously adopted council norms and procedures, which include guiding principles for council civility in their interactions and communications. Now, therefore, the City Council of the City of Atascadero shall promote the use of and adherence to the principles of civility and civil discourse in conducting business with elected officials, staff, and citizens.
Thank you, and thank you. We have some representatives here from the League of Women Voters. If you could please share. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having us, and thank you for adopting that proclamation. My name is Marguerite Bader. I'm the president of the League of Women Voters of San Luis Obispo County. We really are grateful to be able to give our little presentation tonight. We're going to all the cities and many, many governmental bodies. The South County Sanitation District, tomorrow, Women in Agriculture, Los Osos CSD, just a huge range of governmental organizations, large and small. The League of Women Voters was founded about 95 years ago, and the women who got the right to vote formed the League of Women Voters right after that to meet the needs of 20 million women who were just given this power and really needed to know how to vote. How do you make these decisions? What issues are important? What candidates are the right ones you should be electing? Locally, our league is 53 years old, and it was founded by Cal Poly wives. Their husbands were professors or worked at the university, and it was 1962. Women stayed at home with their children. They didn't so much work outside the home, and so they wanted something really interesting to do. So these women formed our original League of Women Voters. So today we have over 100 members, and even though that seems like a small group, we're so powerful in our influence given the small numbers that we have. We hope we are, anyway. What we never endorse a political party or oppose or support a candidate, so we try to be completely nonpartisan. However, we do study issues and take positions on the issues. So one issue that really drew our attention was the issue of civil discourse. There's been a study that shows that 60% of Americans think there is a decline in civility in the United States. When this happens, it affects the League of Women Voters because our motto is making democracy work. And when people are not civil, democracy withers, and when they are civil, it flourishes. We don't want people not coming to community meetings because of the harshness and the anger and the bad language or the personal attacks that might occur at a meeting. This is not good for our democracy. Our mission is the informed and active participation of citizens in government. So anything that affects people's participation negatively is a real concern to us. So we are promoting civil discourse throughout the county through education and advocacy in hopes that we will get better public decisions and procedures as a result of this. I'd like to introduce our Director of Civil Discourse and First Vice President, Sharon Kimball, who initiated the study and carried that ball forward. So Sharon will tell you how we're trying to get the civil discourse message out.
Thank you. I'm Sharon Kimball, First Vice President of the League of Women Voters of San Luis Obispo County and Director of Civil Discourse and the recent chair of the study. I have always believed in people working together and being respectful. So when an opportunity came after the last presidential election at our program planning meeting, and people were very discouraged by the inability on the national front for elected officials to work together and find common ground and solve all the critical problems we have. We have so many, as you know, on not only the national level, but state level. Here, water being one of them. Climate change, which we've really seen directly here in our state. I want to thank Mayor O'Malley because when we did the study, we reached out and we asked all of our government officials and mayors in our 7 cities of the county, what are you currently doing? And you are already currently doing a lot of good things regarding, as you mentioned in the proclamation, you had in place council procedures and so forth. And I want to thank the City Council and especially Marcia Torgerson, who's been extremely helpful and informative. And I want to let you know that we're not just the women voters anymore. We have men. In fact, 30% of our membership now are men, and we have a man on our board. And so we're very excited. And we couldn't have actually, the suffragettes, and there is a movie now out with Meryl Streep about the origin of our group when they were struggling for the right to vote. Couldn't have done it without the husbands that helped in that fight. So I want to tell you a little bit about, we have over 1,000 chapters across the United States. We have a national league, a state league, and in the state of California, we have 70 chapters, the biggest group of league of women voters in any state. In May, we went to the state convention, and this first slide is from that. And our segment, which we did with several other league chapters in the state of California, was creating common ground in San Luis Obispo County, which we're trying to do by reaching out to government bodies and speaking there. And to just kind of reiterate what Marguerite Bader, our president, said, we feel like the county works better and democracy works better when we use the principles of civil discourse. It increases civic engagement, it powers the community, and helps it survive and thrive. When we did our study, and I volunteered to chair that, I didn't realize how extremely, I knew how thorough the League of Women Voters does in vetting different issues and things, but I didn't know it would be a commitment of at least a minimum of a year. So I committed a year's time living, breathing, and now it's turned into 3 years. It's been one of the most worthwhile events because it's transformed me and my study committee. We find that we have become better people and we can interact better and connect better in almost every situation, even in very contentious and divisive situations. So I can't say enough about how important it is to use these principles. So we wanted to find a definition and a best practices. This is the definition, which could be more lengthy, but people wouldn't remember it. And so we tried to capture what we thought were the main principles, and that is courteous, constructive communication characterized by mutual respect, fairness, and attentive listening. And all of that sounds good, but really doing that is a bigger challenge. Really committing to that, being courteous, not and being respectful. But you'd be surprised that when you do that, even with people you may not disagree, it transforms not only the person you're talking with, but you as well. And we can't change other people, but we can change ourselves and how we respond and react, and that is transformational to everyone that you're working with. So in real estate, we say location, 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 but in civil discourse and the political environment, it's leadership, leadership, leadership. Because the person in charge can make all the difference in how these principles are carried out in a meeting in many different ways. If you have a leader that isn't the most civil, you can take a leadership position on your own as a member of the community or a member of the staff or a member of the council to lead by example, by yourself showing respect in actions and body language and speech. And a lot of people think that just what you say, but your tone of voice and your body language and communication, body language is everything. We have these little tells that sometimes we're not aware of, rolling our eyes, making gestures inadvertently. So we really need to be conscientious. And it's especially important in this digital age because what you say and how you say it and your body language can be replayed on YouTube and a lot of other places, so it's really important to be conscientious and in the moment about what we say and do. We are all for free speech, and when we first started talking about this, people were concerned that we were going to be impinging on that. No, we just think that If you frame what you say in a respectful way using these principles, people are more likely to hear your message and act on it. One of the things we found out that you can do as a leader is to provide adequate time. Most people provide 3 minutes. Sometimes it's two, depending on what it is. But by not cutting people off immediately, letting them finish their thought and so forth, that's one way of being respectful. Listening actively. We hear, but we don't always listen because we need to have an open mind and an open heart. We have our agenda, so when something comes up, we need to clear that and really be in the moment to listen to what people are saying, because you can learn a lot, surprisingly. And to speak truthful without distortion and the facts, that's very important as a member of the League to be, we stress that, by we try to get the facts. Don't comment on the motivation of a speaker and promote discussion on its merits, the merits using evidence, and remind people about the rules of conduct, and always encourage people to be respectful. So we found that these are the things that a lot of government bodies use. They have codes of ethic and conduct, and Robert's Rules of Order, which has an interesting story. This was a general that had to go out and hold a public meeting, and he was used to the military, which is very structured, and you are respectful as part of the military to whoever your commander is, and then suddenly had to go out to the civilians and conduct a meeting, and it was a complete disaster. He was just so embarrassed and humiliated about how things went very badly. So that's the origin of Robert's Rules. He was never going to have that happen again, so he created these. And actually, the revisions of this have been done by family members. There's actually a genealogy. Until this last year, because of the internet and all of the electronic phase, they brought in an expert from Berkeley in California to add some of the new chapters. Also, California's Brown Act. Almost every state has something which dictates that we have public meetings open to the public, and this is our act. So we studied that. Ordinances, resolutions, and pledges all help in respectful meetings. So we created a resolution, which was read earlier in terms of a proclamation about the different principles. So in the interest of time, I won't go over all of those. But again, we think that informed discussion, you can make better decisions when everybody that's all stakeholders are there. And I love to see citizens as I go out that participate. We need more of that. Our last election had the worst numbers here in California of any election since the 1800s in terms of turnout. And voter service is a big part of the League. We go out to promote that, and we try to protect voter rights. We have a lobbyist in Washington, D.C., and we're out there on all sorts of issues advocating. So what are we going to do in the future? After we go out and talk to all of the different government bodies about the principles and promote this, we have two organizations within the League that we have formed. One is an observer corps, which we will attend meetings and observe but not speak, as far as the level, not only the level of civility, but issues that may come up that we have positions to advocate on behalf of. And then we'll have an ambassador corps, which will be present to maybe speak at public comment time with tips on how to maybe improve the quality of meetings and remind citizens that then when they do their presentation to try to follow those procedures. There is a National Institute for Civil Discourse that is associated with the University of Arizona, and there is a gentleman by the name of Ted Celeste who goes across the United States training legislators on how to reach across the aisle when they are a part of different parties to solve these problems. And we are hoping to have we've been in discussion with him about offering a civil discourse training workshop, possibly in the spring. We will have a speakers bureau. We have brochures that we published that are on the back table that we, and also we passed out to each of you. We have buttons, like I have on here, about I love civil discourse. And we are hoping to put together a curriculum for the schools and workshops to help with that, because we feel like we're better when we work together, and we work together better when we're civil. So I want to thank you, and if you're interested in helping us with the cause, we'd love to hear from you, and thank you for allowing us to talk about this.
Thank you. Of course, you know E.G. Lewis was a champion of the woman's right to vote and was very active in that movement early on and with his publishing company. So we appreciate your work in our community today. We're going to take a little break and have all of those that made presentations come up, same order, and we'll just take a quick picture for the press here. So please join us in that same order. Well, as we often mention, so much of what gets done in our community is through volunteer efforts. So to take some time to recognize those that have done so much in our community is always a pleasure for us. Next item on the agenda is the consent calendar, considered to be routine items, not needing a lot of discussion unless a member of the council or the public would like to pull one for further discussion. So of those, is there any member of the council wishing to pull an item or a member of the public? Seeing none, I would entertain a motion on the consent calendar.
So moved.
We have a motion by Councilman Fonzie, seconded by Mayor Pro Tem Moreno. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Fonzie?
Yes.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Moreno?
Yes.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Thank you. Next, we have updates from the city manager. Then we'll go to the community forum.
Thank you, Mayor. The first item I would like to talk about tonight is one that we've been talking about and probably will continue to talk about, especially if the El Nino, the weather that we're predicting is going to come true. So I'm going to turn it over to Nick DeBarra, Public Works Director, to talk a little bit about stormwater preparation, what we've been doing, because we have been working hard at preparing for the rainy season, and asking people to do their part too. So, Nick?
Thanks, Rochelle. The city's been really busy the last 2 to 3 months as we've prepared for what tends to be, as a meteorologist expect, to be a really rainy and wet winter time. And we've been we'll continue to do these things in the upcoming months as well, but we've been busy cleaning and maintaining the drains, the storm pipes, the culverts, the gutters, and maintaining trees, making sure we take down the trees that we feel like are going to be hazard or not have enough a limb, taking off limbs so the wind can blow through them while we get those ditches, ponds, and so forth. We also have done some really great improvements the last few years with regard to flood protection. We had the Marchant Avenue flood mitigation project, which really alleviated that whole section of town, amongst other projects as well. We've really been busy trying to reach out to the public to make them aware of how they can prepare and their responsibilities with regard to drainage and storm water runoff. And we're really encouraging everybody in town to really plan ahead for this because, as I mentioned, there's a lot of hype out there. And with all this hype, we've gotten tons of calls, not only the Public Works Department, also the city manager's office and maybe some of the other departments as well. And a lot of these calls, folks are asking us to come out and take care of that, you know, drainage way behind their home that, you know, hasn't seen much water the last 4 years. And quite frankly, we can't go out onto private property. So we've been really busy on the public property taking care of our responsibility, and really the homeowners really need to help out with this, because without that, if they just let things go, that's going to just go downstream, and usually our facilities are downstream, and they get affected by that, and then everybody gets affected if our facilities get affected. Some of the things the property owners can do is really starting with their homes, kind of clearing the gutters and making sure the downspouts are directed away from their homes, making sure the grades around their home are sloping away, getting positive drainage from their home. Also, checking culverts and drain pipes, any drainage ways on their property, making sure they don't dump those leaves and that green waste in that low point in their, on the side of their yard that, you know, might actually carry water this year that hasn't carried water the last 4 years. And then also looking at trees around their home, trimming branches, taking care of any limbs that are rubbing against the side of their house or on the roof to prevent any damage to their home as well. And then really, as I mentioned, don't blow the leaves or grass clippings into the streets or ditches or ponds or any other waterways. Our storm sewer is really designed to only handle the worst storm event that happens every 25 years, statistically. So that means, you know, if we get the rain like they're talking about, we're going to have flooding in the streets, and that's normal, because if we were to design for, say, a 100-year storm event, we'd have huge pipes, a lot of drains in the street. It would really become cost prohibitive to do a lot of these projects. So that's why the 25-year storm event standard is held to these storm pipes. Ponds, on the other hand, those are 100-year storm events that we designed for. So, you know, that's to disallow any of the homes or structures to be flooded out. The a lot of the Blue Line creeks as well. We've, you know, as many of you have seen, we had the creek cleanup a couple weeks ago, and this past weekend, the Friends of the Lake did a great job organizing the cleanup around Atascadero Lake. Looks great, Nancy. So a lot of these Blue Line creeks as well on private property, homeowners need to be aware of that, and the city can't come out and really maintain those. However, if they get the go-ahead from the other California Fish and Wildlife and others to go ahead and clear some things out of there, they can, but they need to be aware of that. Also, we've got sand that we've stockpiled over at the Fire Station 1 and at the city courtyard over on Gabarda Avenue. We also encourage folks, if they do have some flooding or think they need sandbags, to purchase these sandbags at Miners or Home Depot or anywhere else, and then they can go over to the fire station or the courtyard and fill those up. As I mentioned, these oak trees, you know, they should be aware. They've been really stressed the last 4 years, and we expect some trees and tree limbs to drop. And, you know, we got to really be cognizant of that, and homeowners need to be aware of that. As these tree limbs drop, they often take down power lines or other things that really become dangerous at that point. And then also, you know, really be prepared for any storm-related power outages. Make sure you have flashlights, batteries. Make sure you have some water and food around in case you get stuck at home for a couple days. If you have generators, make sure you have fuel for that. Make sure they run. You know, if they haven't been started in a couple years, maybe, you know, dust them off and see if they give them a little tune-up. And then, again, if any residents during the rain events, if they see any unusual localized flooding, if they see any downed trees blocking streets, if they see downed electrical lines or anything like that, they need to call the emergency dispatch number at 461-5051. Again, 461-5051. And the dispatchers will call out the emergency crews to come out, usually Public Works, but also police and fire will come out. There is a handout that the city put together, this orange piece of paper. Maybe the city council got it, but there's some on the back table here. We'll put on the website and start promoting this a little bit. It's a good overall general handout that explains some of the things I just talked about. One other thing I just might mention, too, for next year, what I've noticed is a lot of properties have, property owners have sprayed herbicide on slopes that were normally had weeds or some kind of vegetative matter on it. And I'm really concerned that, you know, by doing so, if we get a lot of heavy rain, that's going to displace a lot of that soil or other matter that could cause. So if any homeowners are thinking about, you know, I understand it looks great to have that nice clean embankment and everything, but that those weeds and that vegetative matter really holds that soil together on those slopes. And you know, we'll keep our fingers crossed, and if anything comes down off the hill, and you know, just call 911 if it's an emergency, or the dispatch if it's an urgency. And hopefully I caught everything. Maybe Rochelle has anything else to add.
I think you covered it. I'll keep going if that's all right. Zubu update. So we had a great time at the annual Zubu and Veggie Carving Contest at the Charles Paddock Zoo last Saturday evening. It was very well attended, with higher ticket count than last year's event. From all reports and firsthand observations, everyone had a great time. All of the kids and their costumes were adorable, and the zoo looked great, all decorated. The lights were incredible. There were a lot of kids having an amazing time. We had a couple of amazing artists with our veggie carving contest that did a great job. The pictures don't do them justice up here. So it was a great event all around. Lake Perimeter Cleanup Day. So that was also last Saturday, and we had a total of 35 volunteers show up Saturday morning, including Councilmember Kelly, who brought his drone along to help capture the efforts. Five Cal Poly students came to lend a hand as part of Make a Difference Day. Erica Banner donated the services of Dan's Gardening from Paso Robles to assist with the work. And we had a total of 5 20-yard dumpsters completely filled. The majority of the cleanup was done on Lakeview Drive and at the pavilion by the exercise course. It was a very productive day, spearheaded by the Friends of the Lake, including John Tremble, Nancy Hare, who's here tonight, Don and Don Lynch. We'd also like to thank our city staff, the Friends of the Atascadero Lake, and all of the volunteers for making this event a success. The Friends expressed their deep appreciation to city staff and for the city's support of the cleanup effort. We also want to be sure to give a special thanks to AJ's Kitchen for surprising the volunteers with a free lunch of chicken, chips, and drinks, which were very welcome. The Friends of the Lake will continue with their efforts throughout this week until our permit with the Department of Fish and Wildlife ends on October 31st. And for those of you who missed Saturday cleanup, well, you have another chance. The Friends are looking for volunteers to come assist a crew who will be working at the lake this coming Saturday. The city will provide another dumpster. We just need some extra hands to pick up the cuttings, place them on a tarp, and take them to the dumpster. The work will be on Marchant Way, south of the pavilion. Volunteers who can help out on Saturday are asked to please show up at 8:30. So they really accomplished a lot last Saturday. They're continuing the amazing work that they've done. This is a great group of volunteers. And if you missed it last Saturday, we have another chance this Saturday. So 8:30 on Saturday. Upcoming events. As usual, we have a lot more upcoming events. We're going to start with the Veterans Day Memorial Ceremony. It will be held again this year at the Faces of Freedom's Memorial at 11 a.m. on Wednesday, November 11th. A barbecue lunch will be held at the Lake Park following the ceremony. A very moving ceremony, well worth attending. And to say thank you to the men and women serving both here and abroad, we will hold Armed Forces Day event on November 14th at the Charles Paddock Zoo during regular zoo hours. All active duty Armed Forces members and their immediate families will receive free admission to the zoo with a valid military ID. Taco Day on Traffic Way is Saturday, November 14th, 2 to 6 p.m. This is a new family-friendly taco tasting event where visitors can shop and eat their way down Traffic Way. Tickets are $10 and are available at the Chamber in advance or at the Carlton Hotel on the day of the event. Each ticket will be good for 5 different tacos, each from a different taco vendor, which is a really good value and should be lots of fun. I'm looking forward to this event. It should be exciting. And then this will get us right into our holiday season. We saw slides for holiday boutique, holiday lighting, walk around the lake, winter wonderland, a bunch of very exciting events coming up after that. I'd like to turn it over to Gerald and have him give us a brief update on San Gabriel School and transients and other police issues.
Thank you, Rochelle. Do want to bring council and everyone else listening kind of up to date on where we're at with the San Gabriel School incident. Fortunately for us, is a resolved case now with a suspect in custody. Unfortunately, the suspect happened to be a juvenile, and it was a little bit distressing for us to find that out, that someone had undertaken that action and gone to such great steps to cause such discomfort and harm to members of our community, and as a result is looking at some serious consequences for their actions. What I would prefer to let council know about and just kind of celebrate is the level of success that we saw as a result of this incident and the subsequent investigation. Unusual in any law enforcement career to have something of this magnitude happen. It's certainly the type of incident that I've never seen in nearly 25 years of law enforcement experience. The complexity of the crime and the depth and breadth of the investigation is something I doubt I'll experience again in my career. When we initially responded on September 11th to the incident, there was a great cooperative effort between members of the first responders and the schools, and the schools have remained our partner all throughout this incident. We had an excellent representation at pretty much every event and every meeting, every time we were out. We had somebody from the schools there with us, working hand in hand with us, and the school district really has been a partner, and that partnership is one that didn't just happen. It's a result of the kind of continuing efforts that we have made to be good partners with our schools over the years in planning and preparation for events. I was going to say events like this one, but unfortunately, it really isn't anything much like this one, but for catastrophic events that might happen on campus. And typically, we have talked about active shooters and things of that nature. Fortunately, those plans that we have in place and the way that we work with the school district is excellent for use in a situation like this one or any other that might arise. And so what we saw early on is that those plans that we had in place to evacuate the school, keep our kids safe, take investigative steps immediately after the incident, mitigate any harm that might come to teachers, students, members of our community, really did fall into line right away and worked out very well. And so we should be proud of that work that was put in ahead of time, and then we should be as equally proud of the fact that when we actually carried it out, it went according to plan. It's what we have planned for and prepared for, and it worked. I'd also like to point out that in the initial response to this incident, there were 9 or 10 different agencies that responded to deal with this on the very first day. Certainly the fire department, Chief Stone's folks, and the police department were the first ones to arrive on scene and worked cooperatively to deal with the things that we had to deal with at the very onset. But then we saw a great amount of assistance coming to us from our local partners, both in fire department and hazardous materials response and in law enforcement capacity. And within really a matter of moments, an incident that could have easily overwhelmed our resources was able to be managed and handled appropriately by the number of people who responded to assist us, from the California Highway Patrol, the Sheriff's Department, Hazardous Materials Response Team, State Parks, Probation Department, and I'll leave some out, I'm sure. The list is just very long. Of particular note, of the 10 initial responding entities, two really stayed with us and partnered with us throughout the course of the investigation. The district attorney's office and their district attorney investigators responded with a large number of their investigators to help us with interviews and conducting follow-up investigation, and remained an active partner in the investigation throughout the course of time that we were looking into different suspects and persons of suspicion and things of that nature. They really have been a continuous active partner with us, especially at the investigation level. And then in addition to that, the local office of the FBI, I've had a great partnership with Brian Sullivan, the special agent in charge in Santa Maria, for a number of years. And one of the very first phone calls I got was from Brian, and he said, whatever you need, we're here to help. I'm sending up a team. So he didn't even wait to hear from me what I needed. He had already had a group of people on their way up here, and they really did partner with us throughout the course of the investigation as well. Processed a large number of evidentiary items that were seized, helped us by, at one point in time, they had two FBI agents and an analyst stationed full-time at our department for our disposal, and the volume of work that they were able to produce on our behalf was really substantial. And so a case that, again, easily could have overwhelmed us was easily managed and handled as a result of the cooperative efforts of all of the different partners that we've groomed over the years. That's a tribute to our city, to the people who have been involved long before I ever got here. I'm proud to repeat this time and time again, every chance I get, that the case was actually solved by one of our own people, one of our investigators, Sergeant Jason Carr, actually did that nose-to-the-grindstone kind of detective work, that old-fashioned police detective work that you see on the TV shows. And that led to the revelation of one significant piece of evidence that really is what turned the tide and identified a suspect in this case when previously we had had none. And the use of that information is what led to discovering a number of other items of evidence. And so with all the help that we received from other entities and other agencies, I'm proud to report to you that the best of what happened was one of our own people here at Atascadero PD. And as a police chief, that makes me very proud. And so I brag about it all the time. You'll hear me say it many more times before we're done here. It was our own folks that actually really did the piece of evidence and the casework that solved this case. We literally could not have done it without everybody else, though. A large part of what we've been doing since then and what we'll continue to do is to kind of try and reassure members of the public, our teaching staff, and the students at our schools of their safety. This incident has put a significant amount of fear into kind of the hearts and minds of our people. We heard that time and time again through the course of our investigation, that people were afraid, they were scared. We understand that and certainly have tried to take those steps necessary to reassure people by our increased presence at the schools. I'm walking tomorrow with the students from San Gabriel. They're having a walk-to-school event starting at 7:30, and so I'll be walking alongside of them again just to continue our presence on those campuses and continue our interaction with the schools. We don't want it to die just because we've solved the case. We want to continue to make them, reassure them of our presence and reassure them of their safety by our presence. And so, long and short of it, there's a lot of work left to be done. There's already literally hundreds of man hours of investigation that have been involved in this case, to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars in financial cost from overtime and man hours and staffing. And yet we're not done. There's a long way to go before a prosecution can occur. There's a lot more steps that have to be taken. And so we do expect that we'll have people working on this case for many weeks to come before we finally see it through to its conclusion. On another note, we've previously said that we kind of thought this was a lone incident. It's not something we're likely to see again. But we have uncovered some information that led us to believe that had we not intervened, had we not located the suspect, these types of incidents may have continued and or gotten worse. And so we're very grateful that we were able to resolve this case without any further incident or any further action being taken against the students at our schools. And we are, along with you, breathing a great sigh of relief in that. I'll also, to move away from that topic, I've been asked to address kind of some increase in activity that we've seen in our downtown corridor, some incidents that have caused concern from people doing various criminal conduct and loitering and other things, and especially in the area of our sunken gardens. It is something that the police department has been aware of and took note of, and really even before we started receiving complaints from members of our community, we were already taking some increased steps to try and be proactive and deal with some of the issues. Much of the issue stems from the fact that we were actually really good at our jobs in another place in town. And because we were good at our jobs working with both the fire department, Kurt's people, and the city attorney, we took some action against some properties that were causing a large number of problems within a neighborhood. A lot of those individuals were displaced because of our enforcement efforts, which has given great relief to that neighborhood. And unfortunately, that displacement has caused problems now in another location. We are very grateful at the council's actions over the course of the last couple of years in providing us with tools in the form of municipal code changes that have given us the ability to deal with some of those issues. Again, we are, as we've talked to council about in the past, we're more concerned with conduct than status. So whether somebody is considered transient or not doesn't really matter. It's the behaviors and conduct that we are concerned about. The things that we have seen an increase in is littering, smoking in the park, the unlawful or inappropriate use of some of our property in the area of the sunken gardens. Some of you may have been down there recently and just seen some of the landscaping is just getting destroyed. We've had some issues with trespassing and public urination. Those are the kinds of complaints that we're getting from people in the area. We've also seen an increase in the number of camping violations, and so those are the kinds of things that we are taking some enforcement steps with now. We'll be meeting again with some of our, we call them partners, some of our partners in the area, those business owners, employees, and people who frequent the areas on a regular basis to make sure that we're being appropriate in our response and make sure that we are taking appropriate enforcement action when necessary, and to encourage them to be a more active, vital role player in the solution to the problem. What we're finding oftentimes is that someone will complain, and you all hear about that eventually, and we'll go to the individual and ask, well, did you ever call the police? Well, no, I called the city council. Well, you guys are great, and you do a lot of good work, but I think really what we would encourage people most is when you see a violation, when you see illegal conduct, the appropriate person to call would be a police officer. And let's get the officers out there dealing with those problems. And hopefully, by doing that, we'll see those problems decrease and there won't be a need to call the mayor or the city council to seek their resolutions on things. We do feel that we have appropriate criminal statutes to deal with the issues that we're facing. And so I don't, at this point, have any recommendations for council and don't foresee any in the near future for increased legislative action being needed. We're just simply going to start using the tools that we have at our disposal and doing a little bit more activity in response to some of the complaints that we're hearing. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you have on that, unless the city manager would request that I don't.
Thank you, Gerald. Actually, I think we'd be happy to answer any questions on any of the topics tonight.
Okay, council members. Yes. Gerald, do you notice if we're having an increase in the homeless population in town? I know they had the point in time count here not too long ago, and those numbers really came in low. Although everybody that represents down there at HSOC said, hey, the numbers are going up. And it appears that there are more people in sunken gardens. Have they just relocated, or are you seeing an increase in people coming to our town?
What we're experiencing right now is clearly a displacement issue. We took significant steps to clear up a couple of properties in town recently where we had a large number of individuals illegally camping out in backyards, and it literally had become kind of a campground in the middle of a residential neighborhood. It was a very inappropriate use for those residential areas. And so when we took that enforcement action against the property owner and took steps to kind of clear out those areas, a lot of people were displaced. There is room at the shelter. Unfortunately, many of the individuals involved, we're finding, have been barred from the shelter because of misconduct or abuses in the past. And so we're in the process of, in a couple of instances, trying to find them alternative places to stay. I've been in contact specifically with family members of one individual, just trying to find a place for this person to go. But I don't think there's an increase in the number, just more of a displacement issue.
With the prediction of El Nino, they're talking possibly 50 inches of rain, which will be miserable for these people that are out there. Do you have any suggestions on how we might approach that situation when it comes, what we can do to help these people? I don't mean to put you on the spot.
I have a ton of suggestions. I'm considerate of the time. Number one, the individuals that we most come into contact with have every opportunity to utilize the shelter system that you guys put in place. Again, it was your legislative action that led to our Echo Shelter being available to people when they're in need. Far too often, those beds go unfilled. Now, there's in some cases a reluctance to use the shelter system because there's rules in place that individuals don't want to follow. For instance, you need to show up and be sober. That's a difficult rule to follow for some individuals, unfortunately. There are other reasons why people have been barred from using the shelter. When they're there, they've committed violations, rule violations, gotten into fights or other things that have caused them to be barred from the shelter. Oftentimes what we find is, you know, specifically in the case of the individual I was dealing with yesterday, this individual has access to shelter, has access to monetary means of sustaining himself in that shelter, and yet for one reason or another is currently choosing not to use that. And so in some cases, we're going so far, again, yesterday, my sergeant and I were talking to the individual. We got information on a family member. We're going to reach out to Adult Protective Services. We're going to try and find a way to encourage this individual to get indoors because it simply is not healthy for him to stay outside. Again, though, we can't force that. That's difficult. So in most cases, I would say to you that the options are there. The opportunities are there for people to take advantage of those options, and they're simply not doing it.
Thank you. Councilwoman Fonzie.
Thank you for your report, Chief. Appreciate that. A question about the upcoming activities we have planned for the Sunken Garden area. We have Winter Wonderland, and we have the lighting ceremony and other things going on for the Christmas season. I'm wondering if you're anticipating any issues with transients and those activities?
Not really. Many of those activities are taking place during the nighttime hours, and what we're finding is that our Sunken Gardens areas are cleared out during nighttime hours. The individuals are going somewhere. We've also been working with Public Works, with Nick Navarro's folks, to address some of the issues as far as dealing with landscaping and some of the other blighted issues in the park to really get us kind of spruced up so that we're ready for those events. We want that to be a welcoming, warm environment for people to come enjoy. And so we will be addressing some of those areas that are most impacted right now with some landscaping issues. I've just addressed that today, as a matter of fact, with some of his staff. And so I don't anticipate that there'll be a problem. However, as you guys know, I go to most of those events. I try to be there for all of them, and when I arrive, if I see anything, certainly we will call in some additional folks to help us deal with any issues. We want people from the community to feel completely safe and secure in coming down and enjoying the activities that are available to us here in Atascadero and have just a good, fun family environment and atmosphere for them to enjoy.
Very good. And I understand several of the churches have stepped up in the past. I remember specifically the Father's House had a place for people to go during certain types of weather. Have they been contacted to see if they're willing to participate again?
I have not personally. A number of churches have stepped up and done different programs. I know Father's House has been involved. Refuge Church has been involved. There are a number, again, of active, available programs and opportunities for people to take advantage of. I don't know if Father's House is going to open up again this year as they have in the past. My assumption is that that answer is probably yes. Typically, though, they'll open when the weather turns cold, as opposed to when the weather turns wet. So it remains to be seen. I certainly can follow up with that. The pastor at Father's House is one of the chaplains on our staff, and so we have a connection.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Other council questions or comments for the chief? Okay, well, just finishing up with Chief, we did have the topic of San Gabriel come up at our City Schools Committee meeting just last Friday. Councilwoman Fonzie joined me from our council, along with three board members. And again, everyone was very complimentary and reiterated what you have said, that this good partnership working with the school, but very complimentary of police and fire and all of our staff's interaction. And I think people did feel we were keeping our community safe. So again, thank you for doing a good job. And we do have some other questions for the city manager. First, Heather Moreno.
Rochelle, I was wondering if you could give, or maybe it would be you or Nick, to let the public know about the citywide cleanup day this Saturday.
I will pass that over to Nick. There is a citywide cleanup day.
Or I can let you know about it.
If you want to take a shot, I can fill in the blanks.
Okay. Well, it's just this is the opportunity we have. It comes twice a year for the public, and this is through Waste Management, our hauler, where twice a year, the last Saturday in October and the last Saturday in April, they provide a free garbage day, you could call it. So you take it over to the courtyard anywhere between 8 a.m. and 2 p.m., truckloads of green, recycle, or trash, and it's free, as many car truckloads as you want to take over. So we'll think that. Sometimes people don't know about that. You tell them after the fact. When does that happen? So it's always that last Saturday in October, last Saturday in April. Take advantage of it.
Very good. Thank you. Other council comments or questions or any concluding words from our city manager? Concluding our city manager report, we'll move on to community forum, which is your opportunity to speak to us on any item not on the agenda. Welcome, Pastor Shively.
Thank you, Mayor and Council and staff. Like you said, I'm Pastor Steve Shively from Refuge Church, and I want to say a prayer for the meeting. Before I do that, I wanted to share a few things. This Friday evening, starting at 6 p.m., we're having our annual Harvest Party at Refuge Church for families and kids, giant slides, bounce houses, games, all kinds of good stuff. So just want to invite everyone out to that. And then also wanted to share that there's a new radio station in Atascadero, 103.9. It is a radio station of our church, Refuge Church. It's 24 hours, 7 days a week, Bible teaching and Christ-centered praise and worship music. And pretty good lineup we have on there. If people are interested in that, in that, I think they'll be really blessed by it. So pray for the meeting. I think the meeting's probably almost over by now, isn't it? But it's okay. Heavenly Father, we just bless you tonight and praise you and just thank you that you are good to us, Lord. We thank you for giving us this day. And thank you, God, that you are just the giver of all good gifts. They come from the Father of light sent from above. Lord, we just thank you for our city, for our community. We do want to pray, God, your hand of protection over it. We want to pray that we would be a grateful people in it. We want to pray, God, that you would just meet people at their point of need, even in some of these things that have already been shared tonight, God. And, Lord, that you would draw their hearts even to you and the things that you've provided for them. Sometimes people don't know about those provisions, and other times they just willfully ignore them, but we do commit those things to you, God. Just pray for wisdom for our council and for those on our staff, hedge of protection around our police and fire department and others, Lord, that just serve on the front lines in our community. And absolutely, God, above all things, I want to thank you for sending your Son, Jesus Christ, to the cross of Calvary to make a way of forgiveness and salvation for all who would humble their hearts and call on your name. And so again, just thank you for our evening and your goodness to us, and just want to pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you.
Pastor Shively, before you leave, while we've got you here, and I do want to thank you on behalf of the council for all of the ministerial association and all of your involvement in the community. You know, we've been talking a little bit about services for homeless, and I was wondering if you could maybe speak to that with what you know of some of the other churches, and I think you have an outreach. Mm-hmm. What are some of the services you're aware of for homeless in the community?
I know there's a lot out there. What we provide is actually on Tuesday evenings. Let's see if I get the address right. I think it's 7800. I should know this. El Camino Real downtown. We have a rescue mission down there, and we provide groceries, clothing, home-cooked meal that night, and several other resources for homeless and low-income people. We generally, on a Tuesday night, get anywhere from 30 to 60 people who come out and take part in that as well. I think what we've created is just a really warm atmosphere where people can come and get prayer and even, you know, small degree of Bible counseling and that kind of thing. And we've seen a lot of people actually see their lives turned around through there. A lot of people giving their life to Christ. Folks, we've seen people get jobs, get off of drugs, get into homes and so forth. I think what we really provide is kind of the personal touch. We know a lot of the homeless people in town and try to build a relationship with them and found that to be really effective. Also at the same place on Thursday evening, we have a recovery group for those struggling with substance abuse, and we get a pretty good turnout of that as well. And hopefully in the future, we're even hoping to be able to kind of expand some of the services with that. So that's the main thing I can speak to. I know a lot of churches are involved with Echo in town, I know you're familiar with their services. And off the top of my head, that's probably the best I can do.
Pretty good.
On that, so.
Thank you.
I thought you were going to ask for a picture, so I'm glad. That's all. So.
Somebody take his picture.
No, I'm good. I'm good.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good evening, Mayor and Council members. My name is Nancy Hare, and I am a member of Friends of the Tascadero Lake. I'm just here representing our board to let you folks know how grateful that we are of your support of our third annual Lake Perimeter Cleanup Day. Not only did you provide the dumpsters, you provided us with a staff person who had an actual chainsaw, which was really exciting because we can't use any power tools. We have to cut everything by hand. And it was just, we can get a lot done with all that going on. So you guys have been really supportive of our group and what we're trying to do. And we just want to say thank you. So thank you.
Thank you. Look forward to those aerial photographs from Councilman Kelly sometime. I'll have to get it up here on the screen. Okay. Any other members of the public? Seeing none approach, we'll close the public community forum and move on to next item. We have no public hearings, but we do have a management report. First, Charles Paddock Zoo monument signage. And is our city manager taking the lead on that? You're going to put
Going to pass that to Alfredo Castillo, our planner.
Very good.
Tom?
Good evening. So hopefully we'll make this short and sweet. Some good news for you tonight. Before you is an item from the Charles Paddock to your monument signage. As you spoke earlier, you know, this community is all about volunteerism, and this project is the epitome of goodwill and volunteerism and folks doing what's best for the community as a whole and really highlighting the best that Atascadero has to offer. So with that being said, So a little bit of background, the City Council did approve the Zoo Master Plan in 2004. So the Master Plan is very similar to the City's General Plan or our Downtown Vision Plan, where it's completed in phases. So as money comes along or as donations come in, we're going to complete items that overall fulfill the vision of the Zoo Master Plan. Some of the projects that have been completed include the Zoo Entry Facelift, ADA restroom facilities for ADA stands for American Disabilities Act, the new gift shop and food service area, and then recently you had approved a memorandum of understanding for construction of a new Red Panda exhibit, and so hopefully that construction will be starting up very soon. Also recently, the zoo has been graced with a new statue of Charles Paddock, which was completed and was dedicated on July 4th. This was a project that was completely funded by private donors. So as a part of this funding, as a part of this effort, the group recognized that the front entrance signage needed to complete the look. So what they were looking at is it needed to have a bolder, greater entry statement. The statue is a great touch to it. It's a great honor for Mr. Paddock to be as a statue. But again, really making the zoo pop and that really entry feature to let people know, not only residents that know of the zoo, that know it's there, but also mainly the visitors who were really trying to attract those from the county, those from outside the county. And so really, again, showcasing what Itasca has to offer. So this group began some additional fundraising efforts to do not only finish up the monument or the statue, but also do a brand new monument sign. So this is currently the location of the proposed zoo signage. The Charles Paddock statue is on your left-hand side. And then this is a photo simulation image of the proposed new monument signage. It is it's thematic, thematically consistent with sort of the zoo themes that we've already previously approved and gone over. So it's, again, it adds a nice touch, puts an arch to it, provides sort of that pop for the entry for the zoo. So this is, again, a sketch of the zoo monument sign that was originally submitted to staff for review. And then this is an additional sketch of the monument sign itself. So again, it about 56 square feet in size, and a beautiful sign to be, you know, colored, and again it adds that added pop to the entry feature. And this is a color rendering that was done by the artist. So again, in summary, it's a total of 56 square feet. The total sign height is 16 feet, and that's measured from the ground, and it may be removed if additional vertical access is required. So that was one of the things that we were looking at as city staff, especially zoo staff. Alan's here to answer any questions in regard to the signage, but they were looking for the ability to, just in case we need additional room to get larger items into the zoo, that we wouldn't have to remove the sign constantly or find ways around it. So this instance, the monument sign is built so we can quickly remove it and then put it back together in order to get that additional vertical height going. So as a part of the construction of the sign itself, a private group is funding the monument sign. So this has been a private group effort of multiple donors donating to this cause. A building permit will be required, and signage installation will be completed by staff. So there is a small fiscal impact as a part of that, not only the signage installation, but the review of permits, which is done by city staff, the inspection of the signage, and finally that installation portion. So that's the one fiscal impact that is noted in your staff report. So the council does have three alternatives before you on this item. The council may include modifications to the proposed project for approval. This did go to the Parks and Rec Commission, and the Parks and Rec Commission unanimously recommended the sign design as is, and staff is also recommending the same thing. The council may determine that more information is needed. Let me know if you need that information. We can bring this item back to you at a future date. You may also deny the project. Why you would, I don't know, but I have to offer that alternative for you. The council must specify those reasons for denial of the project, and I will help you make any associated findings with such an action. So again, this was seen by the Parks and Rec Commission a few weeks back. They are recommending the City Council adopt draft resolution approving the proposed monument entry signage at the Charles Paddock Zoo, and I will open it up to council questions.
Thank you. We start to have some council questions appearing, though I do want to say after the Colony Days Chamber Mixer last week, I made it over to the Planning Commission, and of course Chuck Ward made a great presentation, as he usually does, along with Mark Greenaway, the artist, on this, and they of course had the help of Mr. Baker here to make a good presentation on this. And I wanted to see if you would like to add anything at this time, or you're going to wait for a question, but this would be an excellent time to make a comment. And then since Councilman Kelly was all involved on the committee that kind of ended up moving in this direction, we'll give him an opportunity to add any comments next, and then we'll go to council questions. Welcome.
Thank you. One of the things that's been a little bit problematic is when the front entrance was redesigned and the gift shop was installed, due to some changes, inadvertently, the whole front gate system was kind of eliminated from the project. So when the project got done, we kind of went, oh my gosh, we don't have a sign, we don't have a gate kind of thing. So our hope was always to come back and put a sign on there. And of course, you know, other things came up, accreditation, things we had to focus on. And it wasn't until we were able to talk to Mr. Greenaway and Chuck and some of the other people that were involved in the statue and kind of mentioned to them how that really had kind of dropped through the cracks there. And they thought it was a great idea too. So it really just kind of came together very, very quickly. And it's something we've been looking forward to for a long time. So we're very, very pleased with the design.
I was glad to learn that it's basically a removable, that if you had some need for some large equipment, you could still take that off, get in, and access. And so it's functional and beautiful. So thank you for your input on that one.
Thank you.
Councilman Kelly, you want to fill in some of the process in there as you were involved with the committee?
Well, just a little ex parte, I guess. I'm co-chair of the committee that put together the Charles Paddock statue and the sign, but have to give full credit to Chuck Ward. He's the workhorse behind the whole project. Towards the end of the statue project, we had a lot of people came forward that wanted to donate to the project once they could see what the finished product was. So I guess we ended up with a little bit of extra money, and Chuck got on the idea of the sign, and here we are with the sign. So I want to thank Chuck and Mark Greenaway and the other members who are on the committee, and I really want to thank all the citizens in the community, not only at Atascadero, but throughout the county, some that gave some very significant donations so we can upgrade our zoo with this sign here. So I don't think any conflict voting on this, since there's no monetary gain or anything for me.
Thank you. We have first questions from Councilman Sturdivant, followed by Councilwoman Fonzie.
Well, I want to say thank you to everyone involved in this project. Just what a great spirit we have in our city of community involvement, and just everyone getting involved and seeing a hole and filling it. So I really appreciate that. Actually, my question is actually more of a service question when it comes to the size of the sign and actually moving it. I was kind of curious because it's 12 feet up in the air and it's 56 square feet. There's got to be some weight there. It looks like it's made from metal. So I was kind of curious, like if you said today, hey, let's move that sign because we've got something coming in, the safety of that, is there a certain way it's going to have to be done, weight, that kind of question?
Safety is always a priority number one to all of our workers. Of course, we'd have to bring in some, more than likely bring in some heavy machinery to get that done. Nick would be a little bit more familiar with what we have possibly in the yard for the sign installation. But most certainly, we would need additional, it's made out of steel and powder coated, so we will need additional machinery, to usually a cherry picker or something to that effect to get up there and get that done correctly.
So it will take some work. It's not something you just get somebody on a ladder and say, hey, let's take this sign down. It doesn't work that way.
Typically, no. It's probably not safe to just get the ladder. Maybe on a three-man crew. I don't
there
know.
There you go. Okay.
Safety first, though.
Thank you.
Well, I understand it probably will involve a forklift, but I understood from the Planning Commission that there's no more than four bolts on each side. It might even be only two.
That's correct.
And so there's not a lot to take apart. And then you just need somebody either really tall and strong or a good forklift. But it seemed like that could be handled. Councilman Fonzie.
Thank you. Just a couple questions about this. Is this zoo sign going to be on both sides of it or just facing outward?
From my understanding, it is just facing outward because with the powder coating that's done in the applique. So basically, they have to frame in the metal. So the metal portion is you'll be able to see on the second side, but you know the powder coating one should typically just be on the front. Again, that's mainly what you're going to be looking at as you enter the zoo.
I wasn't as concerned about the word zoo in the Charles paddock. It's the tree. It's going to look a little odd if it's not a tree on both sides.
And that's something that, you know, I wish Mark were here, he could probably describe it a little bit better than I can. But, you know, that is something most certainly I'm fairly confident they took into account as a part of the design of the sign itself.
Very good. And do we have an idea how much this is going to cost or how much is needed to be donated?
Well, the funds are already raised. I don't know if, Bob, do you know what the total cost is?
The funds for the sign are already accounted for. I think the only cost is to staff time just to put it in place, if I understand correctly.
So in other words, donations are not needed at this time?
This project is covered. There may be new ones, but...
Of course, we'll always take donations, you know, there's no...
I'm sure you will. Okay, thank you.
From discussing with Mr. Ward, the donation's already done. They are accepting, and they will be going after donations for materials, which would obviously have been an excess fund for additional work as needed. But again, that was as discussed by Mr. Ward and myself. We had a brief discussion about the materials and possible, and they will be seeking donations of those materials as well, again, to help alleviate the additional costs. But they so far have the money to cover everything.
That's great. Okay, thank you. And I think this will be a great addition to the zoo. It'll be like frosting on the cake. Very nice.
And my understanding is that it's painted on both sides. It looks very similar to a similar gate that... Bert Johnson made and Mark Greenaway painted that I've seen. So I think that is well thought through already. If no other council questions, we'll open it up to the public. Seeing no one come forward, we'll close public comment. And did I hear a motion from you, Councilman Kelly?
Yes. Whoops. Okay. Did away. Recommendation that the Parks and Recreation Commission recommends that the council adopt the draft resolution approving the proposed monument entry sign at the Charles Paddock Zoo.
Second.
We have a motion by Councilman Kelly, seconded by Councilman Fonzie. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Councilmember Fonzie?
Yes.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Moreno?
Yes.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Thank you. And I think we're moving on to council announcements and reports. And I think we will be giving a little more detail under the city manager because we asked staff to follow up on a couple items. So I'd like to take a brief break at this time, and then we'll come back, I think, go through our announcements and reports pretty quick, but then the city manager will be leading a follow-up on a couple of items. So thank you. Let's take a quick 5-minute break. I do want to go back to where I try to go periodically and kind of stick to how the agenda is broken down, because we do have council announcements and reports first, which is really your own activities or things you might be involved in the community. It's an opportunity to speak to those. Then we're going to go to committee reports, which are the formal appointments you have, and give that. And then at the end, under individual determinations, that's where if there's something that you think the council should take some action on, or you've got a question to raise, that would be the time to do that. And in response to our last meeting, when we had a couple, the city manager is going to respond to a couple of items that we directed them to last time. So again, let's stick with, I'm just going to go from my left to my right for council announcements. Anything you want to report on from in the community?
No reports.
Well, nothing was said about colony days, and I thought it was a fantastic day.
Yes.
All around, parades and Tent City and everything, and the Tent City After Dark, which I wasn't there because I was exhausted, but I hear it was fantastic. So just thank you to everybody who, you know, from staff to the myriad of volunteers in the community. It was just a great, great day as always, and enjoy that and appreciate all the effort that goes into it. I did, with Lighthouse, we set up a booth up in Paso at the theater for the Kayla Peach Foundation. They had an event where they show a movie called The New Face of Drugs, and then had several volunteers that were there to speak, from an ER doc, an ER nurse, someone from DEA, coroner's office, and just answer questions. And they had, I'd say, you know, somewhere in the 70 or so range of people that came, you know, and it's free, obviously, no cost, and was very interesting. It'll be I'm interested to see what we might learn from that and be able to bring here with Lighthouse to our community in terms of education and awareness and all of that. So stay tuned.
Thank you. Well, I will just mention that once again, Mayor Martin and I teamed up to co-host an event with North County Quest to Chorus as a fundraiser, and that was they had an incredible turnout in our community supporting their activities. And then I have to just do a proud father moment. We attended the countywide Teacher of the Year appreciation, where each school district had their nominees for Teacher of the Year, and of course my daughter had received the Teacher of the Year for Itasca Unified School District. But what impressed me up there was how many Atascadero residents actually were recognized and got awards, because the young lady who received the Teacher of the Year award for Cuesta College, for example, is one of our Atascadero residents, and there were a few. In fact, the person that got the countywide award is her husband is one of our teachers here in our school district. So just interesting to see how well we represent ourselves in some of these community activities. And again, I thought Colony Days was great. People did say it was a really good turnout, and I think what's really has helped, and again, we need to commend Don Clickard and the schools. I think Paso had about two bands in their parade for Pioneer Days. I think we had like 10, and it's because of, again, the school has put together that band competition on the same date as our Colony Days. And I think that's really helped with the parade. And again, commending the folks involved with the little bluegrass and beer, what a combination, right after Colony Days down the park. And I know our own Terry Banish really helped with jump-starting that and getting some of these events expanded. So I think it's good to have a little extra resource to help on some of those kind of things. Councilwoman Fonzie.
Thank you. Have an upcoming air pollution control district meeting. It should be interesting. We're evaluating the executive director. I will keep you posted on the outcome of that. The civil action and discourse may come in very handy at that meeting. Went to a LAFCO meeting this month, and one of the items that came up is the possible dissolution of the Cayucas Fire District, that apparently fire districts are having a hard time with the volunteer manning, and so there is talk about that. I know it's been an issue with Templeton having some problems as well with that. So I think it will be an ongoing issue. I'll let you know what happens with that one, but it looks like they may be going to Cal Fire in the near future. I attended the school's liaison meeting, actually. That was very interesting, my first time to attend that one. We talked, as Mayor O'Malley stated, about the San Gabriel school incident that was reviewed, and very complimentary comments were made about their interaction with our police department and other staff. Talked about safe routes to school that will be coming up, that they'd like to get some money for improvements. As we know, there's no money with Slow Clog for that at this point in time. One of the things that may come up in the future and may need to be talked about is the opening and closing times for ECHO. They said there's a conflict between dropping off kids at the high school and kids arriving, and the arrival in the morning, they leave the shelter at the same time. So there's some interaction sometimes between the homeless and the school kids with parking and other things. And also when they arrive in the afternoon, they come back to the shelter at exactly the same time the school gets out. So it may be something that needs to be reviewed and talked about further. Talked a little bit about a crossing guard or need for a crossing guard, which may involve the city as well. And this would be at El Camino Real near Shore Station. You go out from underneath the underpass from the high school, and there's the blinking light there where kids go through, not all together, but one at a time, and kind of dawdle along, and the traffic backs up and people get impatient. There was talk about not knowing what you're supposed to do when you're there. If there's no kid in the crossing walk but the light's still blinking, you get a ticket if you cross, those kind of things. So it may be a public information or education item as well. And that's it for me.
Thank you. And I think there was some thought that the school may initiate some training with their students about etiquette or politeness on grouping a little bit, going across those lighted crosswalks. Well, we did kind of merge in council committee reports along with announcements, which is okay. I gave it a try. If Councilman Sturdivant, do you want to have any announcements and any reports you want to throw in? You might give a little mention about the League of California Cities.
I have no reports. I did see that the marijuana initiative did get signed by the governor. So that is something that's going to, we do have the framework to give us, the city, the structure to be in, have control over the process and be involved in it rather than being, you know, at its mercy. So it's going to be interesting to see when it goes to the recreational, which they're talking about, because I'm hearing there's quite a fight that's already from the smaller growers, because when it gets that large, there's going to be the big people, a lot of money are going to be involved. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. But we have a good framework, so that's where we're going to work from. But other than that, at this point in time, that's all I've got.
Thank you. And for those of you that followed my direction and only gave an announcement, do you have any committee reports over here? You're...
I think I'd just like to add on to another additional cleanup day up the lake. I attended that, and it was remarkable how much they really got cleaned up. And you can see the progress that they made. And, you know, I've always considered the lake one of the crown jewels of our city, so I hope if people are available this weekend, they could go out there Saturday and volunteer some of their time. It's to the benefit of all of us. And I'd like to thank the Friends of the Lake for the work that they do.
Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem.
Yes, I attended the Atascadero TBID, Tourism Business Improvement District, meeting last week. And the committee there, are they called officially a board? Are you called a board?
Yes.
They're the board. They're very, they're really getting going. So they have a lot of advertising they've already been doing now that we have the logo and everything in place, more things in print. They already have a pretty heavy media campaign underway, social media and other digital avenues. So they're really gung-ho, and also getting the website, at least their portion, which is a good part of that, visit atascadero.com, up and going. So they're moving forward. I'll be at the Economic Vitality Corporation tomorrow, and then on Friday, luncheon meeting hosted by Gail Stork, president of Cuesta, will be talking about the educational master planning.
Very good. Thank you. I have no more reports on that will move right on to the individual determinations or action. I assume there's nothing new to bring up by council. We'll turn it over to the city manager to follow up on a couple of items that were discussed at the last council meeting.
Thank you, Mayor. At the last council meeting, Councilmember Kelly raised some concerns regarding the purchase and the refurbishment of our fire trucks, and most particularly, why do we send employees back to Wisconsin as part of the process? As a result of Councilmember Kelly's concerns, the council asked staff to bring back an oral report on the travel involved in the fire truck building process, and we've asked Kurt to give that oral report tonight, so I'll turn it over to Kurt.
Thank you, Rochelle. Good evening, Mayor and Council. You know, it's funny, when Councilman Kelly brought this item up 2 weeks ago, the next morning my wife and I left on vacation, and it was kind of funny. As the vacation went on, I was so excited about, imagine that, fire chief getting to talk about the fire department. So bear with me. I put down quite a bit of notes, and I put together some slides, because it dawned on me we've never explained to the council, other than an oral report, which the previous city manager gave after we took him back. You guys have been kind of left out of that, and with the exception of Councilman Sturtevant, never have experienced it. So bear with me here. You know, it's kind of interesting listening to the night as it's gone on. Kind of the theme tonight was volunteerism and donations, and we're going to have this discussion because of a wonderful lady in our community, Bertha Schultz, who donated $1,040,000 to the fire department. And interestingly enough, when we were back completing the final on our newest engine, and that she helped pay for well more than 50% of, we received notification from the fire department, my admin assistant, that Mrs. Schultz Trust had donated another $250,000 to the fire department. So with that, let me explain. And again, Brian's going to kind of got some insight here, and so it's kind of unfair in a way. I am so proud of the fire department because the amount of work that goes into speccing and designing and building, and that's only part of it, is then taking that fire truck and bringing it home, and then outfitting it and putting it in service, kind of doing the shakedown and working all the idiosyncrasies out of this new piece of equipment. So I'm going to show you some slides. I'm going to show you us working when we're back there making these hard decisions. And so I first wanted to give credit to Bertha and to the fire department staff, because they're the ones that really make this thing work. You know, when I became fire chief, the fire staff had no voice in buying fire trucks. Prior to me becoming chief, every fire vehicle that I watched purchase from 1984 until 2001, the fire chief bought the fire truck. And I think that'd be kind of on par with, I don't know, maybe one of our newest firefighters buying my computer, my desk, my workstation, without completely being in tune with what he or she needs in their job. And so I brought a whole new perspective to designing fire trucks. I wanted the end users to build their fire trucks. Now, granted, we just can't turn the kids loose in the candy store, and I don't mean that in a derogatory fashion, but those of that have been back to Pierce, Jerry being one of them, previous city manager and assistant city manager, there are so many options, so many turns that you can make. It's probably on par, for those of you that have built homes, it's probably on par with spending 3 days making every decision about building a new home, down to the color of the grout, the color of the trim, the type of water fixtures, the type of appliances, and at the end of 3 days, every decision down to the nth degree has to be finalized, and then you have to sign the blueprints, and I mean actual blueprints, from our newest engine. I have a satchel of blueprints which has the forward elevation, the right elevation, the left elevation, the rear elevation of the engine. It also has an aerial view of the engine. We actually have to sign a graphics blueprint so that once they put on whatever graphics that were requested on the engine, if there's a misspelling, it's on us. It's our responsibility. In departments that put on gold leaf, that could be costly to the tunes of thousands of dollars if gold leaf had to be redone. I'll give you an example of that in a little bit. The blueprints also include every gauge, button, switch, on-off switch, battery switch, microphone, radio, every position of every instrument or gauge or switch in the cab. has a full sheet of blueprints that you sign off on where those gauges are located, and you sign and agree to that. Just to kind of give you an example of what some of the decision processes are made. I was told by the salesperson, if you didn't know which fire truck you wanted to build and you chose one from each of the 9 main lines of fire trucks and you followed all of the decisions to the conclusion, you would make roughly 34,000 decisions down each one of those 9 brands, varieties, models of fire trucks. So let me move forward here a little bit, and Luke, if you'd pull the slides up, I'd appreciate it. The previous city manager, when we took him back, it was pretty cool. They have this one light. It's called a, we call them spinners in the fire service. It's called, the actual trade name is Roto Rays, and this is a 3-position light that sits on the front of the fire truck, and when you hit a toggle switch, those lights turn on, and the light spins. And previous city manager says, how come you guys don't have those? I said, well, they're really expensive. He goes, yeah, but they look cool. I go, boy, they look cool, because when they turn on, I mean, they let everyone know. And these lights that are about 4 inches in diameter, about the size of a headlight, there's 3 of them, they actually spin. And, I mean, they spin so fast it looks like a swirl. And so we were walking around the plant comparing our engine to the other engines, and he said, hey, this engine's got 2. And our salesman, Kerry Eckert, turned around and he said, that's because they'll be the first in the county to have 2. Well, those lights cost $2,250 a piece, and that doesn't include the labor to install, the wiring, or the switches. What I somewhat in an accident stumbled on with the previous city manager is I felt that it was absolutely imperative for fire departments and fire chiefs who responsibly buy and spend public dollars, even though Bertha donated it, they are public dollars, and she's entrusted us to make good decisions, whether it was donated money or city dollars that our taxpayers have paid. They expect us to make good decisions, and I thought, what better way than to have the city manager, assistant city manager previously, and our finance director come back as kind of the auditors, if you will, of our decisions. And there's nothing that compares to being back at Pierce at the manufacturing plant and to see the assembly line and the process. I'm going to talk about the benefit of training here in a few minutes, but let me walk through the process of what it takes to design and build an engine. I started out with a few of our less modern engines. The one in the background actually has no box on it, and the firefighters actually built the box, the bed that went on that old engine. Oops. I can't advance. Sorry about that. So this is where 4 days is spent. Well, in our case, we did it in about three and a half days. And the very first time that we went back and built the 2 engines, the sister engines that are being refurbed right now, we literally spent from 6:30, 7 o'clock, right when they'd first let you into the work area back at the Pierce plant. We'd stay there until they kicked us out right around 7 o'clock. And those that went with us this last time saw what that was like. We were the last ones to leave this last trip back there because we had so much work to do. And I'll explain why we had so much work to do in a little bit. This is where all the decisions were made. And when we got done, we still had not concluded the build, the design of these engines. And the design blueprints for that engine are basically this binder, and every decision that was made was reflected in this binder. And then we spent four and a half hours on the airplane ride from Chicago back to Los Angeles with the salesperson, our basically agent, sitting between us on the airplane seats, and we had blueprints laid out in our laps, and we almost finished when we got to L.A., We had not finished, so we actually agreed to get back together and meet for about another half day to finish up the build spec and design. I would rather have, and I just had a root canal, and I would rather have a root canal again than go through that process. It's miserable. It is. You get to the point where I just don't care what color the grout is. I don't care what color the trim is. Just make a decision. Let's move on. And the other thing that's so challenging is constantly evaluating the cost benefit. Okay, if we buy this, is it going to serve the community? Is it just a spinner that looks cool, or is there a real application that's going to help us do our job, our primary mission, better? And those, that analysis is just utterly exhausting. Here we're in someone else's engine, and that's Captain Gaw, who was on the first build team that went back there, and trying to figure out engine positions. And if you look up above them, all that crud hanging down from the top are more engine switches and positions for emergency warning controls and other features throughout the engine. And we're struggling with, okay, ergonomically, what makes most sense? And then, whatever we decide on, can we replicate this in the future? And we did when we built the truck and when we built our newest engine. Every compartment has a blueprint, and you have to decide how the equipment is mounted, where the equipment is mounted, why it's mounted in the position it's in. Is that consistent with the culture of the organization? Have we always kept the engineer's compartment closest to the engineer's panel? In the Tascadero, yes, but in some cities, they don't. And so we had to make a bazillion decisions in figuring out where and how we were going to stack and prioritize our equipment. So these are all decisions, and these were pictures we took when we were in the pre-build phase. There's more pictures of the cab. This cab is actually completed. You can see all the switches and buttons above his forehead right there. And those buttons and switches continue all the way over onto the captain's side with three identical panels that have about 8 to 10 switches per panel. You have to make graphic choices. I've seen one fire truck with over $50,000 in 24-karat gold leaf, gold ornaments on it. I don't know if Huntington Beach has got gold or not. I was just using this as an example. All of the ornaments, the badging, the designs, the reflective, that white stripe is a reflective tape, all of that has to be approved, bought off on. You have to have certain square inches of that reflective tape on the side of the engine. Where do you put it? High, low, middle, make it look like a waistband. All of these are decisions that have to be made before the engine can be built. And then one of the biggest decisions and one of the hardest decisions is how are we going to lay out the engineer's panel? And we want consistency so that the engineers at 2 in the morning when they're fighting a structure fire, every button switch and water control and gauge is in the same position on all of our engines. And we struggled to work with a very small width engineer's panel because the wider the engineer's panel got, the less crowded it was, the less complex, the more functional. But every foot we add to that panel added a foot to the length of the engine. Hence, the turning radius got bigger and bigger and bigger. As you all know, Tascadero has some pretty narrow, tight roads. So everything was a battle from bumper to bumper on this and fighting ergonomics, utilitarian function versus length of the engine and what could we kind of balance and find kind of the best for what we needed here in Atascadero. Now when we get to the midpoint, this is the opportunity where we go back and look at the fire truck as they're actually taking the big box and assembling it and dropping the tank into it. This is one of our engines. They had just put the box on that morning. Our crews had a chance to look, inspect, take pictures, ask questions about all of the wiring harnesses. I'll show you some wiring harnesses in a little bit. And to gain a more kind of holistic understanding of how these trucks are built, why they're so complex. And hence, I think this flops forward to having our finance director and our city manager come back and have the opportunity to see that these things are big, they're expensive, and I know why, and what I hope they bring away from it, and the city manager will bring away from it is, wow, our staff really made good decisions. They were good stewards with those tax dollars. And again, the learning is priceless. Here's one of our engineers' panels, the pump area that pretty much makes all the water move anywhere on the truck, and this is in the assembly phases. We struggle to rebuild those valves behind the engineers' panel. Having the opportunity and talking to the engineers and the folks that actually install these valves and could teach us tricks while we were back there and how to rebuild these valves. And in many cases, I chuckle because I've been guilty of losing all my knuckles trying to rebuild these valves. And some pretty simple things by the pros really aided our department in improving our vehicle maintenance and recognition of rather than waiting for a failure, seeing indications of failure prior to the actual failure. Having the ability to inspect the quality, most people would be thrilled to have this kind of electrical work in their house. This is all 110 and 220. This is high voltage stuff, and you darn well want that stuff done right or else somebody's going to get hurt or electrocuted on the engine. This is what it looks like in March. That's when this crew was back doing the midpoint on that engine. Everything's dead and cold. This is the midpoint on our ladder truck. And what's interesting is somehow there was a failure between our plan and the engineers that actually built this engineer's panel. That entire engineer's panel, that entire layout was wrong. It actually came from another truck, another spec, and they had to redo it, and we caught it. So every piece of blue tape up there, and you see, and whenever you see blue tape, that's an error or a mistake, and we write on there, and we make notations about what's wrong and why it's not similar. Now, this is our truck, so we're trying to build the engineer's panel to match our two engines so they're identical, and there's no screw-up in the middle of the night at 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning when we're fighting a fire. And this whole thing had to be redone, and it was on Pierce. It was their mistake. They admitted it. We wouldn't have found that, though, until it got out here or until the final, and then the final would have really delayed our receipt of the ladder. Anyone that knows or has a diesel vehicle knows that the EPA and the emissions thing has become a major impact. And while clean air is great, Carrie Eckert, our salesperson, said clean air is not cheap. What you're looking at is an exhaust system that used to be about 10 feet long, and now it's 24 feet long. And what you basically see, that spaghetti, those noodles of stainless steel piping going zigzagging back and forth, that covers the entire bottom of the fire truck. And what really is happening is that's a serpentine of exhaust that's going forwards and backwards all the way around till it wraps all the way around the engine and comes out the tailpipe right in front of the tire there. And this is to provide clean air. This exhaust system, the motor changes, and the cooling system changes from this engine that we just purchased from our first engine is a $72,000 increase is what these EPA emissions cost. I'm not arguing that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm arguing what Carrie says, clean air is expensive when it comes to diesels. Here's one of the wiring looms that comes into one of the command centers on the dash of the engine. That's what's behind all that black vinyl stuff on the dash. What's so amazing about Pierce is the minute an engine rolls up on the assembly line and moves to its new position, everyone from the lead foreman to the newest wire tire jumps up, grabs a broom, cleans the floor. I mean, the workstations and where these engines are built is pristine. You could probably drop your sandwich and pick it back up. Then the engines hit the blue room floor, and this is where the finals take place. And the blue room floor is obviously named that because of the blue floor there. And you know, it's interesting, the first time I took our city manager back, engine pulled up next to ours that was backed in there. Ours were two over from the main entrance. And it was this pretty, I'm not a big fan of green fire trucks, but it was one of those green fire trucks, but it was pretty, and it was massive. Really high sides that go up on the back of it where the hose bed is. And it was so funny because we were in there first. We were in there right as the sun was coming up. Those guys sauntered in about 8 o'clock. And the minute, it's kind of like comparing neighbors' gardens or something. First thing they do is they come right over and they go, wow, this is really cool. And they looked at the back of our engine and they said, hey, you have these big aluminum doors across the back where the hose goes. How come you have these aluminum doors? We said, well, out in California, we fight a lot of wildland fires. Embers go up in the air, and what we used to cover the hose beds with was canvas, and then later, the canvas rotted out so quick, later in life, we covered it with kind of a rosin or a rubber-coated canvas so that it resisted water. They still rotted, but the worst thing is, when the embers landed on them, there was probably in the early 90s, before the recommendation for California or wildfire fighting engines changed, we probably lost 8 or 10 fire engines one summer because their hose beds caught on fire, and then the hose underneath that tarp in the hose bed caught on fire. So in California, virtually all the engines, any modern engine that's being built, has what we call clamshells. So imagine big aluminum doors that close over the back. Well, we had the aluminum doors up. We were inspecting some of the dunnage or the cargo area up there. The neighboring fire chief from this other fire department, and they were somewhere from Virginia, came over and he goes, wow, those are cool. We like those. And I said, well, what do you guys have? And I'm looking over at their engine, and it is a big, long name with, I don't know, 20-some characters down the side. We don't name our engines up there because it's really expensive. I think it's a little gaudy. That's why I'm not going to say the department's name on TV here. But they had gold leaf all along there. These letters were about 8 or 9 inches high in character size, 24-karat gold leaf. And the chief turned around to the salesperson and says, I want those. And he goes, and so he came over to Carrie, our salesperson, being East Coast, he didn't even know what the pick was. So the pick is the number that Pierce says, hey, if you want to put these doors on here, this is the pick number. This is how much it's going to cost. Well, their engine was done, just like those two engines. It was done. It was ready to drive home. They sent it back into the shop for 3 more weeks. They took a plasma torch. They cut through the 24-karat gold leaf. They cut the top rails off. They put clamshells on. And I was told by the salesperson the gold leaf repair alone was going to be $10,000 to $15,000. I have no idea what the clamshell addition or retrofit, if you will, because the engine was already completed. And then the engine had to be repainted, because when you cut that kind of stuff off, you're going to destroy the paint job. Probably advise it to be $30,000 to $40,000. And our previous city manager asked, why are you doing this? And he goes, no one in our county has something like this. So to give you kind of an idea of the kinds of equipment you find back there and why I was so adamant on having the city manager and finance director join us is we don't have anything like that on our engines. And I wanted to have the opportunity to explain this to the council and to the public, because a lot of work goes in. These trips are sun up to sundown. This last trip, we got our last flight canceled. We were supposed to be into Appleton around 6 o'clock at night. Our flight got canceled at 8 o'clock, and there was no flight that we could take the next day. We rented a rental car, and then we drove to Appleton, Wisconsin from Chicago. We got into the hotel at 1:15 in the morning. Breakfast was at 7 the next morning, and we were on the Pierce plant floor at 7:30. That night ended at 9. The next night ended at 9:30 or 10. And we still went back to the plant floor Thursday morning before flying home, or Friday morning, September 11th, before flying home. And it was, again, a long night. We got in about 8:30 at night. We got into San Luis at 8 o'clock. What we were also able to do is to do a final on the new engine, like these two engines, 91 and 92. But we also got to go out to the Wairega plant, which is about a 30-mile drive away. And we were able to go out and look at, believe it or not, that is 91. The engine in the background there is 92, and that's 92 as of 5 weeks ago. 92 has been completely refurbished. It's not quite done yet. The engineer's panel on the right has been completely redesigned, and basically they do that whenever they pull the pump out, and they've completely rebuilt the pump and the pump transmission. The motor and transmission were found to be perfectly serviceable. As a matter of fact, on the dyno, after running the motor with its pumps in gear and in drive for 6 hours, and then its motor driving its wheels for 6 hours, the power curve performance exceeded factory stock new on both the motor and transmission. So we were very relieved to see that kind of detail and level of testing on the engines. Also, this is the engine that a local fire truck mechanic. All the mechanics were gone, and one of the sweepers, one of the guys that sweeps up the floor and says a step and go fetch it here locally, decided to take it for a drive and drove it into the side of their engine bay. And if you see all the shiny metal on the top left picture, that shiny metal is where the engine was so badly damaged that all the dent and the bent metal had to be cut out and re-welded back in. Since this was going in for refurbishment, we wanted Pierce to do the refurbishment. Bottom picture is the pump transmission out of this engine that's being rebuilt. I don't have pictures of the pump, plus most people don't quite, they're just kind of a big blob of metal. The right is the engine bed, or the hose bed, with the pump or the tank out of it, and they're actually building an encasement to go around our ladders. One of the flaws with this design was our ladders were always exposed to the wheel wells, and so all the water, road grime, and grit came up into to the ladders. It rotted out the rope that raises the ladders, the halyards. It rotted it out prematurely, and so they have a custom retrofit fix for those ladders, and so that's one of the reasons that they've removed the entire tank, and they're working on that retrofit. And as I get ready, I wasn't supposed to go forward to the next picture yet. Sorry about that. If council's interested, in kind of the sake of brevity, I'd like to or not include the I have an itemized day by day what we did this last time we were out at Pierce and then Wairega. This is roughly 30, 40 minutes away. I tried to cover the questions that I think I heard. I know there were some questions about firefighters' travel. Travel is covered by Pierce. Food is covered by Pierce. Unless we're in travel transit between here and Pierce, we will pick up our own food. This last trip, I think we paid less than $200 for four people. A question about rental car. The rental car, even though we lost our last flight, that was paid for by South Coast, our Pierce dealer, if you will. A question on labor. We never pay overtime when we send our staff back, and all of our staff goes on their own time. Our purchase policy has that proviso in it that our staff can choose to travel because this is incredibly educational. And I have seen probably the training level easily improve fivefold by having our folks, and we always try to rotate who gets to go back there so that we get greater exposure to such a basically once-in-a-career type opportunity for our staff to actually see how their fire trucks and how their fire equipment are put together. We saw some other odd stuff. Jerry asked a question. Salesperson answered the question and said, yeah, this is about an $800,000 fire truck, and it will not respond to a call for 5 years. It's a parade fire engine. And when it hits the floor, their current parade engine, which is now 5 years old, is going to go into frontline service. We saw another fire truck that was a 1932 Mack fire truck that was completely taken off of its chassis, and Pierce bought a used, brand new but used, chassis from a UPS truck, a brown delivery truck. The truck had been hit by lightning, and it fried all of the electronics through the entire vehicle. The insurance company surplused the entire vehicle. UPS took the box off of it and recycled the box, but the chassis was considered scrap. Pierce bought it, and for this one fire agency was taking this old Mack fire chassis or fire truck and putting it on top of the new chassis, and they had redone all of the electronics and replaced all of that because it still had good bones, still had a good motor transmission differential. And the interesting thing was the salesperson there, well, actually he was a plant foreman, he was kind of scratching his head, and I said, why? Why are they doing this? What is the useful life? And they were turning it into a casket-bearing funeral fire truck. So if someone had enough money to spec that, they would not talk about the cost because that was proprietary information, I guess. But the amount of the point is, through some of these stories, the amount of, in my opinion, I'll be honest, waste that you can see or I have seen, and every city manager or assistant city manager or finance director I've brought back has left with the exact same impression. And I personally feel that there's no better way to reassure you, the council, and the public, and frankly, the other department heads. I mean, if I'm Nick and I'm competing for dollars against the fire department, I would not feel comfortable knowing that a fire truck had two spinners on that were just useless other than they look cool. So with that, I'd love to conclude this report and be more than happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Chief. That was very thorough and educational. I'll look to my lights if we have any council questions. Okay, Councilwoman Fonzi, followed by Councilman Kelly.
So if I understand this correctly, there are no uniformities, not like ordering a Ford pickup or whatever that's going to come off the assembly line. Each one is custom made, correct?
Yeah. The chassis is, you have about nine choices. The minute you have the motor, the transmission, everything else is open for discussion. What size pump, how many outlets, where the engineer's panel is, how big the cab is, how many people are you going to seat in the cab, everything from after you decide on the motor, and there's three different choices for motors, after you decide on the motor and transmission, everything from there up is unique. And I really tried to, on the cost-benefit analysis, tried to get our staff to focus on what do we need to do our job to perform our primary function, and is it going to be frequent enough to justify X expense? And that was the challenge. You know, we saw a lot of good things. We saw pulleys and anchor systems that would be great to have on the engine, but we all agreed we might use it once every 3 to 5 years. Well, if it's $100, it's probably worth it. If it's $5,000, definitely not worth it. And so we constantly went through those gyrations and discussions, and that is flat out exhausting.
And if I understood correctly, when Pierce builds this, you come in and inspect it and sign off so they don't have to be responsible if something's wrong. So it's a form of self-disclosure.
Correct.
That protects their insurance or whatever business.
On our last newest engine, which we just took possession of, and we're still in the process of trying to put it in service, they failed to put in what's called bulkheads, which separate the two or the three rear compartments. And a lot of departments want those open so they can put long items in there. Well, our engine, it's right here in the plans, and they completely missed it. And if it would have come out here, it would have absolutely been custom metalworking, and they would have paid for it. Where back there, they simply press a button, and a machine stamps this piece out, and it bolts right in. So, and that's what they want to avert. We had probably 38 to 40 items. When you do your final review, you create what we call a hit list, and then we leave the hit list with the engineers and the basically correction team. And they actually started on it the second night we were there, and we actually got to go back and see significant, about a third of the items were fixed just overnight. The next morning we went out and saw the engine and met with the correction team prior to flying home on that Friday, September 11th.
So forgive me, I'm not a fire engine pro by any stretch of the imagination, but it was my thought when we started out here that you're getting basically the same fire engine you had before. That's what you had told us when we approved the project, but really you have to ascertain that it truly is that.
Correct.
Thank you.
For the end users.
Thank you. Councilman Kelly.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I'd like to make a comment. There's been some talk that this was an attempt by me to put a hit on the fire department. It was no way a hit on the fire department. This information had become available to me because of the Brown Act. I'm unable to talk to other council members about it. So at the last city council meeting, I did bring it up and wanted to come back as a agenda item as it has tonight. I just want to make that clear that, you know, that was not my intent, if some people think that. I have no problem with fire department personnel getting involved, as you have stated tonight. I have bought large pieces of equipment, some of them complex, and it's very, very important that you get involved in the process through the inspection process, because when you sign off on it, that's decision day. I kind of appreciate the presentation you made there with the plans and the blueprints and specification books. Having been a custom home builder for years, I built some pretty complex houses, and I wish I could have had some plans smaller than those in specifications. And a lot of times, just like you had stated, everybody wants more than what they can afford. And there is a process where you get to that number, and then you have to start at the bottom and subtracting till you get to what's affordable, what's going to be functional for the people. My concern is, like I say, I have no problem with the fire department, fire personnel going back there, just on the scheduling that you had presented today. The problem I have is with the non-fire department personnel. Back on October 28th of 1914, which was a year ago, tomorrow, this city council...
2014.
1914.
You're thinking colony days.
Sorry, it's already starting to set in.
I was going to have to say I can't take responsibility for that one.
Yeah, it was those old fire trucks. I'm sorry. But anyhow, that's when the city council approved the purchase of the fire truck and the renovations of the two. And also in the report, it states that 8 months prior to that, you and a committee of three, I believe, started working on this, which you should be commended for. My problem is, as of October the 18th of 2014, we had already approved the project. And by then, I feel that the city manager or the finance director should have been involved in the process up to that point. To me, I can't justify sending people back there after the fact. We hire professional people like yourself. I have all the confidence in the world that you will go back there, design the fire truck that's best for the city. That's what we hired you for. And I know you're cost conscious. I know the city staff is cost conscious. I'm cost conscious. That's why I brought this up.
And I think, just like tonight, the police chief said we've run into tens of thousands of dollars of overruns on the San Gabriel deal. I'm looking at places to save money. And I think that with YouTubes and what have you, if you want to go back and see how a fire truck is made, you can watch it all day long. And my only concern is that we keep these travels down to the fire department personnel only. And that's my statement.
You know, if I could, I'm not sure how you heard about interpreted the fire department or being seen as a hit piece. So I'm not sure where that came from. I saw this as a great opportunity. I got probably too excited 2 weeks ago and answered too much to make the city attorney happy. So seriously, we were on vacation. My poor wife had to tell me 3 times, hey, just knock it off. We're on vacation until next Tuesday. Give it a rest. And you brought up a great question. We've never shared this. And as a matter of fact, one of the things I wanted to do is go back and get some of these older pictures to show how consistent we've been throughout the years in performing these pre-trip or pre-build, midpoint, and final inspections. They're so important to the system. They're so important to the taxpayer. Again, to verify, interestingly enough, this is the new engine, and it's actually thicker, more requirements than our ladder truck, which I would think has far more to it. But with all the EPA laws and DOT regulations and standards, there's just so much more to account for in the time. I just don't know how I don't know how you could, and I don't frankly think Pierce would even enter into a contract if you refused to go back and you didn't make these assessments, because they don't want this mistake in their lap after it gets back out here in California or wherever.
I fully agree with you on it. I don't have any problem with the process that you went through. I purchased a motorhome. I have a book bigger than that. I've got inverters, pumps, wiring harnesses just like you. They're great to look at. I wish I knew how it all worked. And I hope it never breaks. But I don't have any problem with the process that the fire department is going through with the personnel going there.
I appreciate that.
It's just the extra travel that I'm concerned about. And I'm a penny pincher. And that's my concerns. I can't see the justification on people going back there after the decisions have already been made, the checks have already been made, and what have you. So maybe the timing's off. Maybe we're all learning something here. I appreciate you coming and showing us the process. I think something comes out of this good. I'm happy with it.
Thank you. Other council questions? You might want to speak to any audit functions, because Councilman Kelly raised the question about should non-personnel, fire personnel be involved, such as accounting or a city manager. So do you want to speak to that point? What do other cities do, or what is your thinking? As you know, council tries to stay at policy-level decisions. We're not going to. I think it's very useful to have this kind of a report, and it's good for council members to ask questions like this now and then to see the level of detail. But as I used to always say, if I know everything you know, one of us doesn't need to be here. We want to work through the management team and to make these kind of details. We need to know now and then, and I think that's what the value is. Every now and then you look at one item, maybe even randomly. Let's see just exactly what goes into some of these decisions, and I think it's reassuring, I think, for the public and for the council, and it furthers trust. But what about this issue of what I would call an audit function or a finance review? What do you see that role and its importance?
Well, I completely respect Councilman Kelly's opinion and beliefs, and I understand those to be true and what he feels. I believe there's value in involving other members other than just fire department. I felt value in that so much so that I wanted to include 2 previous city managers, current finance director, and the current city manager. I would feel that if I were in your shoes, I would like to kind of have that third party independent. I mean, we hire an auditor to come in and to tell you what our professionals are telling you. And I think there's a overused word, probably the transparency of it is very clear to me. And I would, if I were a city manager or a city council and the fire chief didn't want to include finance in the city manager, my peer and my boss, I would be suspicious if I were a city manager or a city council member. So naive on my part for maybe not asking. I was giving my professional opinion. I think it adds a tremendous amount of benefit for the city finance director and or the city manager to be involved with the fire department, to spend those days talking about what's important to the city, what's important to the taxpayer and to the council. And I think those types of trips, if you will, have a lot of value, and I see a lot of value in them, but I can certainly appreciate Councilman Kelly's point of view and his dissenting opinion or disagreement. I respect that completely.
Thank you. And again, last time we had a brief discussion. It was not an agendized item, so we were very cautious not to get into too much questioning, discussion, or deliberation. It is an agenda item now, so we have much more leeway. This is the chance for any questions folks have on this topic we can address. So I think that's what we're doing now. And again, if action is required, we could, I believe we'd have to agendize that for a future meeting. But again, that is an option. So we'll continue with any council questions or discussion. And then we will offer opportunity to go to the public if needed. Councilman Sturdivant.
Yeah, Kurt, do you use the help of when the city managers went in the past and the assistant city manager, did you use them to help with the review on the Blue Room floor?
Yep.
They
become part of the team.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't think people realize that, try taking your car and looking at every single component on it in, a day, maybe 3 days, maybe a week. You might be lucky if you can do it in that period of time, but now you take a fire engine and you look at every single 5,000 line items or however many there are, there could be 3,500 to 5,000, and every line item signed off. So having extra help there is extremely helpful because every light switch, every piece of tape, every molding, every single item, all 5,000 are approved. So it's nice to have help. So, and the only other question I have is the new engine running urea in the exhaust?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilwoman Fonzi.
So, Kurt, the last time you were there, who went out with you? Was it engineer, yourself?
We had Captain Satterthwaite. One of the things we do so that there's always continuity throughout the build of an engine is the vehicle maintenance supervisor, who is always a captain, always attends every trip. So nothing falls between the cracks if we had three individual different people going each time, there'd be room for error. So whether Peter Gaughan, those earlier pictures, and on that picture right there, that's actually Peter and Scott Satterthwaite. We were mentoring Scott Satterthwaite in because we knew he would be taking over the vehicle maintenance when Captain Gaw retired. And right now we're mentoring Michael Stornetta in, Engineer Stornetta, who will likely take over all of the vehicles when Captain Satterthwaite retires in 2018. So we're already working on the succession plan. So there's always that one constant. And then this last time was Jerry Rangel and myself.
So Pierce pays for your airline. This would be for four people, correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Councilman Kelly.
Did you say that Pierce pays for the airlines?
Correct.
Okay. What determines the life longevity of a fire truck? I know in the reports they say they were good for 20 years, and then with this refurbishment, we'll get another 18 years. Is it based on HOPS meters, hours used on the pumps? And I guess my concern is if this fire truck were in the Los Angeles area, it certainly would receive a lot more wear and tear, I think, over a 10 or 20-year period than it does here in Atascadero. So what really determines the lifespan for our environment for these trucks?
That's a tough question because the fire service has been debating that for a century. In a nutshell, roughly 15 years frontline, 5 years reserve for a 20-year life. That's kind of been the time adage. Now, one of the things we did in our previous engines that we had that those two engines replaced, the fire trucks were completely falling apart at about 16 years. And what we learned, those were fire trucks that were not bought by staff. They were bought by convenience and from the fire chief at the time. What we found with those engines is both of them were underpowered significantly, woefully underpowered. And when you have a motor that is struggling, I mean, just to get itself out the door, to leave a stop sign, to leave a stoplight, that motor pretty much tears itself up. It vibrates terribly. When we had the old 7591 replaced with the new 7591, when we went to surplus it and sell it, we sold it to Sam McGill with a full disclosure so that we wanted them to know everything up front. The cab had over 75 broken welds because the machine was just shaking itself apart. So one of the things we did with these new engines is we asked ourselves why. We actually went to Kern County and looked at a massive fleet of fire trucks, and they had the exact same problem with a fire truck called Beck. And what they had done is they had put what's called a mid-block, a medium-block motor in these engines. Well, those motors were designed to run on perfectly flat ground. Well, Kern County goes from perfectly flat to vertical all over on each side of the county, and they were doing the exact same thing. And it wasn't until we saw their Beck fire engines and we saw how they were basically rattling, destroying themselves because they were so underpowered, that we realized that we definitely need to go with a bigger power plant, given our hills and given our roads. So we went with the Detroit Series 60 diesel motor. It's the big block motor. It gives us more torque, more power. When the existing engine went back for refurbishment, two broken welds with 100,000 miles on it and 12 years of service. So to try to better answer your question, I think it's a kind of an art. I think it's how the engine's built, how you outfit the engine, and we built these engines to be long-lasting engines. Previous engines, we had multiple frame breaks, and we had to have certified welders repair the frames on one of the engines, but the other one we just surplused out and made a disclosure that the frame was broken when we sold that engine as scrap or surplus. I think so much effort went into making these engines last 20-plus years that at every turn, that almost was our paramount. That was almost our calling in our decision process, so that we would not be stuck in the same spot 16 years into it with a fire truck that's fallen apart. I wanted to follow my successor, give my successor the benefit of not having to come back to council and say, that rascal Chief Stone, you know, sold you a bill of goods, these fire trucks are wearing out. And I can truly look you in the eye and tell you that I think these engines are in for the long haul because of a great example, 100,000 miles on the motor, and it still performs after a 12-hour dyno, 6 hours of pumping and 6 hours of simulated road wear and load, and it performs above factory spec when new. I think that's a great indication that these engines are going to serve this community for a long time, and why I think, or why I know, we felt that it was worth the money to refurb these engines.
Well, I think when you brought that to the city council, I think I commended you, because I think it's a great program to refurbish these trucks. And I think there's probably maybe some other equipment in town that we can do that for. With the lifespan and everything that's been in the reports, are we pretty much good now for fire trucks for, say, 15 years or so? We got the new truck at 20, and these new refurbished ones are 18, and I'm sure that 2 or 3 years before that, we'll have to start. So are we pretty well squared away?
We have one engine left that was built by my predecessor, and when that engine's replaced in about 4 years, we're going to be good. Now, the interesting thing is, and one of the reasons I think that made, and what I delivered to you guys, I have the staff report actually, one of the things I told you in the staff report back in September of last year was that the purpose of trying to use Bertha's money to expand and leverage the money that we had in place was to get us caught back up, because we have not been putting money aside for vehicle replacement for 6, 7, or 8 years, and this is going to get that account caught back up, because it pushes the burden of that new purchase off down the road. So we will have money in place to replace the one Wildland engine. Nice thing about Wildland engines, they're significantly cheaper than this type of structure truck.
Will the new $250,000 help with that?
It sure would. We also have a lot of other needs that we're actually doing strategic planning and prioritizing so that either in my tenure or my successor will be able to use to make sound decisions on what the greatest needs are for the department and the community.
I just want to make it clear that I do commend you on the job you're doing as chief with this equipment and everything else. The only problem I have is what I consider the extra travel time, but you and your department are doing a good job with these trucks.
Appreciate it. I'll pass that on. Thank you.
Thank you. We still have some more council questions, and I do want to alert our finance team that I'll be asking a question of you since you've actually gone on one of these trips and kind of see your experience from an accounting standpoint. I know for myself, being more, I was pleased, and sometimes I've been on the hot spot, so to speak, with somebody asking me, that, why would you approve $85,000, I think it was, for breathing apparatus? And to have some detail to say, well, yeah, I support that, and let me tell you what it does. You know, I think there's some real value in having this level of involvement of the council and other staff to really understand your business a little more. So I appreciate that. But I think one of the issues that often comes up is a concern. There's always a trade-off between equipment and staffing. And we've got fire staff designing these fire trucks for some number of staff. And I think that's also a factor where I think we are very frugal and really think through the engineering for these. But a lot of times folks have the question about, because in fire service, nationally, there's discussion, well, do you need more firemen on a fire truck? And how much equipment? And are the fire trucks being designed such that almost now mandatory? You've got an engineer station, how many people do you need to have? And it seems like that's, again, where folks might appreciate kind of like that outside viewpoint. Where like an audit function is, whether it's accounting or cost-benefit analysis, someone is saying, you know, what is the ratio? Is by a better design on the fire truck, are we saving personnel time? Which I think what you've described is a lot of things that are actually making it more efficient and effective in an emergency, by the way. But also, there is that trade-off of staffing and equipment, and it seems like there is some value of that separate audit role. So that's what I'm going to, I think Councilwoman Moreno has some questions, but I didn't want maybe you to speak to that from the finance perspective since you've gone on this trip as well. And if you have something to add to that, Chief, after, that's fine. So we'll go on to Councilwoman Moreno.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, if you'd like to tell us your experience, apparently you went on one of these trips, and did you kind of check out how they were spending our money anyway? What did you learn from this experience, and any thoughts you would share with us?
I did. Thank you. It was actually a terrific experience. It really get a firsthand knowledge of all of the detail and all of the work and planning that goes into this. And really, Kurt and I have had numerous conversations about the equipment and, you know, keeping things rolling and even repairs, maintenance, costs, ongoing things like that over the years. And so it's really great to get that firsthand understanding of their stewardship of the funding and their stewardship of the equipment. And I think that that's really, it's really obvious, it's really evident when you go firsthand and see that. So I can come forward to you and say, yes, they are being very fiscally responsible. I can say that, you know, very confidently. I can look to our community and say very confidently that they have gone through this. They have sweated and, you know, blood, sweat, and tears all over this. I mean, they really, the staff and the fire department, I really have to commend them. They've all just really put their heart into this to use this funding as fiscally responsible as they can to make the best equipment that will serve the community. There's no extra, you know, bells and whistles on this, really, literally. It's just really what is needed to take care of the job. And I got to see that firsthand. I think that's really important, not only for the initial build, but I think going forward as we're talking about maintenance, what's required. You know, how are we going to be able to maintain these if, you know, something big breaks, or, you know, I can better understand what that requires and have a better perspective and give you an honest opinion of, yes, I believe that they're doing everything responsible. So I think it was well worth the trip. I mean,
you don't get paid overtime either.
No.
Now, I think you brought up another point that I think sometimes when you look at the design, another criteria is what's future maintenance costs. And like you say, sometimes maybe spending a little more money on one thing, especially in our terrain, it may save some money on that, and you have a sense of that. Well, are you just sitting there kind of counting, you know, numbers, or do they put you to work? What did you do back there? Were you in that little room there? Was that your coffee cup on the table? What were you doing?
The planning room before I got there. So the trip that we went on, we were actually looking at the engine, making sure from a big list of things that we were checking off everything, finding anything that was wrong, you know, discussing it with the Pierce folks there so that they can go take it back to fix it. So we were doing, I was part of the team. I really felt incorporated, just getting in there and getting the work done. And I felt responsible to do it too. I mean, this is a big decision. We want to make sure we get this right. And I think it's really important. So I think everybody did a great job over there.
Thank you. Any other staff want to comment on that before we go on to another council? Just from that, I would call it a fiscal review, accounting standpoint. Any input, Rochelle? I don't know if you had any experience on this or not, but now is your chance.
I have not had the opportunity to go back yet. I am scheduled to go back on the next trip for the engines, and I'm looking forward to that. I think that Kurt's opinion is a good one. While I respect Councilmember Kelly's opinion on why, okay, I am not an engineer, I am not a fighter, this is not a piece of equipment that I'm going to use every day, I think there is some benefit, and actually quite a bit of benefit, to having a strong understanding of what goes into these engines, why they're chosen the way they are, not only for this, for purchase of this truck, for continuity in the management team itself. Sometimes it's hard for everybody to understand, you know, the fire chief really needs to, you know, buy these engines early because they're falling apart because they're rattling too much. That's a huge expense that is basically hurting somebody else that has a need that's as strong, and really having a strong understanding of why that is. Why is it that we choose the engines that we do? That was one of the things when Jerry came back and she communicated to me. You know, she says, they've thought out everything based on our terrain and what we use that engine for here. I think there were things that you asked about and said, well, why don't we have that? That's a less expensive item. And then it was like, okay, because we have tighter turning radiuses and steeper hills. That works great, you know, in the flat valley, doesn't work so great here. But there were things, you know, I guess there were chains hanging down that you could put in front of the tires. How come we don't have those? Those are great in places where there's a lot of ice and snow, something that we don't need. Therefore, we don't need those expenses. Having just that understanding and that confidence so that when they say, okay, the pump went on the engine and I need $20,000 more, why do you need $20,000? What is that? And having that understanding is good. And the more people that have that understanding, there are the more people there are to spread that message.
Okay, thank you. Councilwoman Moreno.
Chief, I had received an email from someone that was under the impression that there were 7 people going on this trip, but from what you've said, it's only 4, and does that include the city manager, or is it 5 including the city manager?
The upcoming trip would be 5, including the city manager.
Would be 5, okay. And it's all expenses paid other than maybe a meal on the airplane kind of a thing,
or in travel. The airport. We were stuck for layover forever, so we bought food in the airport.
Got it. I mean, I'll just say from my perspective, I mean, once an auditor, always an auditor, I guess. And so it would be easy to look at, you know, getting a financial audit and saying, well, you get a clean opinion, did you just waste, you know, $20,000 or whatever it might be? Well, no, it goes to that audit function, that transparency, that level of comfort that it gives to the public or, you know, whoever happens to be looking at whatever companies or organizations' financial statements. So I do appreciate that audit aspect, and I think it's important. Thank you.
Thank you. Other council questions? Seeing no lights, I'll just check back with the chief. I'll just let you have any final comments you want to have, and we'll bring it back to. I do want to open it up to the public. Let's go ahead and open up the public just in case there is someone here that would like to speak on this item. Any member of the public wishing to speak on this item or ask a question? This is your chance. Well, thank you. No questions on this. I think council's asked quite a few, and I'll bring it back. Any concluding remarks? I will just preface that again. The city council, as we often say, has only two employees in a sense. We supervise, we hire and fire two people, the city attorney and the city manager. And there's a reason for what's called a council city manager form of government. We're not what's considered like in New York, where maybe the mayor actually makes a significant decision, so does the council in terms of even line decisions. We try to keep a separation, and there's a lot of reasons from the history of decision making, but our goal is to look at things from a policy level and have a citizen review is really an important function we take serious in. If the council did feel strongly on something that is in a lower level of detail than normal, we could take that. But again, as Councilman Kelly says, we can't talk about these things outside of this public process. And I think that's good, because you, the public, hear what input we are receiving. If we hear something outside of this public process, we need to disclose that. What went into us making a decision? And you get us, see us struggling through learning some things and asking questions. And I think this has been a really good process. And again, as I said 2 weeks ago, any councilman that has a question should get it answered. And this is the correct way to go about it. You know, question was raised, gave staff some time to come back with that. But we're focusing on a policy level. And if council wants to direct staff on any action coming out of this, that is certainly within our ability. Otherwise, we continue to have decisions from the city manager with department heads, and we respect that as well. So I don't see any other further council questions, and if not, I'll take it back to the city manager. Or you go ahead, Councilman Kelly.
I'd like to get one clarification. It's been my understanding that, I guess I could say, room and board was provided by the fire company, and it's been my understanding that the city paid for the airline tickets, because you mentioned to me that if you weren't going to go, that you would buy your own ticket. So I would like to have a real clear statement of who actually pays for everything. And was that negotiated back before October the 28th of 2014, of how many people overall were going to go back to inspect this fire truck?
Okay, question. I'll turn over first to the chief and then our city manager.
Because I have past experience with buying the new engines from Pierce, that's preset and predetermined, and that's included in the price. I can't answer your question on the refurbishment. It's included, but I don't know how much or to what degree. I'll have to look into that for you and get back to you.
I mean, how much dollars are allocated for that?
Well, we never know how many dollars. It's a number of seats.
Okay, so how many that people would be in some contract somewhere?
I can't ever remember seeing that in the contract.
Councilman Kelly is addressing like our city's contract with Pierce, the manufacturer, and they may or may not have that level of detail, is what you're saying, or you haven't seen it.
I've read the contract a number of times, and I don't recall seeing that in there. On the new engine, what was odd or unique about the new engine is we actually did the pre-trip in my office. We had the salesperson come over from Bakersfield, and we sat in my office for a whole day because we were trying to match it to two existing engines. So it wasn't like we needed to be at the Pierce plant. That then gave us additional seats, bodies that could go back at both the midpoint and on the final. At the midpoint on that engine, we only were able to send two back because we were just under the entire or incredible fire siege in Northern California. So without sitting down and counting each body and actually talking to the sales rep, I can't answer that question on the refurbishment because I just don't know what it is.
Well, let me kind of do a follow-up question along the lines, I think, where Councilman Kelly is going. I think the not asked question yet is, okay, we're buying several fire trucks, and we've already said we want them to be exactly alike. We want this panel to be exactly the same. So the panel we bought last time, we want it to be the same panel. So if we were going to be nitpicky, cost-benefit analysis, a little cost accounting, I'd say, well, let's see. We had four people go last time. We went through all these specs. We know exactly what we want. We want one more just like that. Or are there some components we could knock out, and then could you negotiate with Pierce? You know, we think we only need, I know you know, like four people, you pay for five. Could you drop one, and could we save $1.95? Or how about $20,000 or $5,000 or $1,000? And maybe that's just something that Pierce doesn't do, because I could imagine a company says, look, we work with a lot of folks. This is what we do. That's the package. But have you ever had that thought, or is that ever anything that any other department has done, to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge.
So it's pretty much a standard operating that, let's say, you don't need as much time on a particular trip because we want to try to have things pretty much the same. You're looking at this as a training opportunity for folks that have to work with equipment in an emergency situation, and maybe after an earthquake, and maybe there's nobody available to even talk to get some help, and you kind of got to jerry-rig and keep it going, but you know the nuts and bolts how it's put together, and your engineers know that. You want that experience.
The training is invaluable. Frankly, from a cost-benefit analysis, I can't think of a better return on the training dollar. We have sent extra people in, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we've sent extra people back for the training opportunity of it, and we did cover some airfare on extra people that went back, and Pierce covers the lodging and the meals while we're back there.
But right now, we are not paying any extra. We're kind of taking the amount of, okay, so many folks are approved by Pierce as part of the contract. We don't know how much is allocated that, but we're kind of taking the amount that they offer.
They gave us a bid price. We had another bid from another agency that did remodels or refurbishments on fire trucks. It was within 10% of Pierce. We felt that Pierce was the best suited to work on Pierce equipment, and that's why we made the decision to send it back to Pierce. To answer the specific questions, this is the first time I've ever been part of, this, to my knowledge, is the first time the fire department has ever gone through a refurbishment process. So it's been a huge learning curve for us from start to finish.
Okay. I don't see any more council questions. I think our city manager, could you address Councilman Kelly's question about, okay, just exactly how much has been spent from city funds on this process, and were there any changes at different points in time, like previous city manager, assistant city manager, to now? Councilman Kelly mentioned a couple dates. I think he's wondering, is there been any changes in operating through different points in time?
So let me go back to date on this. As Kurt said, most of these trips all we're picking up are those meals while we're in transit. Not once we get there, not once we land. Those are being picked up. The airfare is being picked up. The travel to and from. Kurt goes so far as to park his vehicle down the road and walk to the airport from the CDF station so that he doesn't pay for, so the city doesn't have to pay for parking while we're gone. They're very cost effective. When we have sent extra people, and those extra people have typically been in fire personnel, we have made the cost, the chief has made the cost benefit determination that it is worth sending those extra people for them to get that firsthand knowledge of that. So again, all of the airfare is included in this. This has been the same process that we have used for the purchase of all of our engines, our truck, and now we're going through the same process on the refurbishment. Councilmember Kelly alluded to the fact that I said that I would be willing to pay for the airfare. This is something that I believe very strongly would benefit me as a city manager and the city, and that was something where I was willing to put my own personal money where my mouth is and still allow Kurt to take his personnel and pay for myself to go too, because of some of the concerns that he had raised.
Okay, well, that's a discussion that must have occurred outside of the council meeting.
It was.
Okay.
I'm just looking at some accountability. I'm sure that Pierce just didn't say, bring back as many people as you want to. If they did, heck, I'd like to go, if it's a freebie. And there's got to be some accountability somewhere. Pierce is a successful company, and businesses just don't do that. I know they can allocate, yes, you're entitled to, the trips in the beginning, trips in the middle, so many trips at the end. But there's got to be some accountability there. How many trips are actually included? And I know you can't answer for me tonight, but I would hope that maybe staff could go through the contract or something and provide me with some information of what is actually allocated within the contract for inspections and travel, and maybe I'll be happy.
Yep, be happy to do that for you. I do know that based on what you buy, it's scalable, and I think Councilmember Sturdivant shared with me that you took back four or five people from PG&E on the pre-build or the final? Oh, and mid. So it can be scalable depending on, when we had two engines, we had a lot more people going back because there was just a ton more work on the final, a ton, because we had two of these binders, one binder for each of those engines. So I'm just not familiar with the refurb portion yet, and I just can't answer your question.
Okay, good. So again, my understanding is, of course, we as individual council members are not going to give the city manager or department heads or certainly any line staff any direction on day-to-day operations. That's in their purview. This is the time for council members to ask questions, and as the council wants to direct the city manager to change our policy or our procedures or give directions, we can do that. We can do it right now at an open meeting in front of the public. But again, I kind of want to make sure the public understands that we don't individually give direction to staff. We are essentially functioning as one person together. We've got a wide range of experience and abilities. We are a citizen oversight organization, and that's our job. It's that check and balance. So these are all good questions, and Councilman Kelly has asked some more good questions. I'm kind of think I know the answer, but I don't know it for sure. So I think following up on that, I think would be helpful for us, Chief, and I think you said you can do that. But are there any this is our chance to have any other questions you'd like the chief or city manager to follow up on. This would be the time to raise them.
No question. It's just been very instructional for me. I didn't understand exactly how this was done. So this is something new. I appreciate the information.
I'd just like to comment. It was very informative. It answered a lot of questions. I still have a couple questions left, and I have some concerns of some of the citizens in town, and I'd like to give them the right answers that we're doing it right. And like I say, except for a couple of the little trips, I commend you for doing a good job getting good equipment for our city, you know, training the firemen. I understand the importance of knowing how the equipment operates, having been a airplane pilot, helicopter pilot. Basically, you want to be able to operate it blindfolded, and you know, you have to know where all the switches and the bells and whistles are. And when you have two trucks, I realize that's very, very important. But like I said, I just have, you know, a couple little things up here that are kind of bugging me at the time. But once again, thank you for the report. It was very well done.
Thank you. And I do want to ask, though, I want to make sure we have closure on this. So I'm going to direct the city manager, or one of our two employees here. Could you repeat the remaining questions that Councilman Kelly has, because we are looking for answers coming back? And the answer may be, Pierce doesn't tell you that, but if we can find out. So I want to make sure that Councilman Kelly has any of his questions answered. So could you repeat what you believe are the outstanding questions left?
So the question that I heard was that Councilmember Kelly would like to know the number of trips included in the purchase of each vehicle. As he said, I'm sure Pierce does not have an unlimited number of people that you're allowed to bring back, but for each contract, how many trips are included in that?
And even if there's some decision process they go through, because yeah, maybe if you're buying two trucks, it's different. You know, what formula do they use? And maybe kind of a confirmation somewhere it says just exactly what expenses are covered for that number of folks. And if they have any performance requirements, they're saying when staff are back there, they are expected to do this. Or if nothing else, they're expected to sign off on this. What's expected? Because they're paying for some benefits for our staff to attend. What specifically are they buying? You know, what is it that's expected? Because that's really on our liability if we don't do that. So it would be good for us to understand that. Any other question, well, Councilman Kelly, that you'd like addressed?
I think there's also a liability factor with Pierce. They're not going to let you take that truck until you sign off on it.
Exactly.
I bought equipment. You buy cars and everything. You're not moving it until somebody who supposedly is an expert tells you that you know how to do it. So, yeah.
I think, Councilman Kelly, you may have answered all of our questions right there. And I think that is right it. With Pierce, it's kind of a negotiated agreement. Here's the price. Here's what you get. Here's what we have to do. Here's what they have to do. But if you can get some more information on that, Miss City Manager, report back. That's fine. Other than that, we appreciate the decision process that your management team goes through for these kind of decisions, because it is tough. You've got multiple department heads vying for lots of resources with not a lot of money all the time. So thank you for that report. I think we can move on unless anybody else has. Okay. Thank you. Well, now we can go on to the second council question that was brought up. I'll turn it over to you on that.
Yes, this one will be a lot more brief.
Oh, good.
At the last council meeting, Councilmember Fonzie and then followed by Mayor O'Malley and Councilmember Kelly all brought up concerns with the closure of the recycling center and what our next steps were. At that meeting, you asked staff to contact Waste Management and start talking with them on what steps could be taken to keep that recycling center open. And that staff has contacted Waste Management. We went with them last Monday, discussed some of our issues, indicated that we would like to keep the recycling center open. So we are continuing. Nothing was decided at that meeting. They'll be bringing that back to corporate, and we'll continue discussions with Mace Management and keep you informed on that. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. It would be helpful to use the lights in case we have multiple. Councilwoman Fonzie.
I know our time is short, that they're talking about closing it in the end of December. So do we have some kind of a time frame that we're meeting again or getting more information? Obviously, time is of the essence.
They asked for a week or two, so we will be following up with them again tomorrow. That's a little short of the deadline. They said they'd be getting back to me, but just to ask, let's set the next meeting.
Are we actually meeting with management, or we're meeting with those further down the line?
We met last time with the government rep for this area and with somebody in California management. They are a large national company. And so what authority level everybody has is open for debate, but it is more than just the local people here. It is somebody with some authority throughout the state.
Okay, and I know that it's probably premature to ask this at this point in time since we don't know what they want to pay for this service, but we have to come up with some kind of an interim plan on how we're going to pay for it. The recycling center is not going to be free anymore. So I just wondered if you had given any thought or staff had worked on any possible alternatives for paying for it.
So for the rates, if we are to keep that recycling center open, obviously that's through waste management. There are several fee structures that you could set. There are also ways that you could pay for it outside of the fee structure, whether you know, the city wanted to pay all of that money and try and find, you know, the $40,000 plus in their budget every year, or pass that on to the ratepayers. Certainly, we're discussing with grocery stores. They are required by law to provide recycling centers to the community. And so if that recycling center closes, this work will fall on our grocery stores. And so trying to get them involved in a solution that benefits the whole community is something that we're also working on. We're looking at different alternatives and trying to be creative on the best way to meet our recycling center needs here in Atascadero.
Very good. I just want to reiterate that I personally am interested in keeping that recycling center open if we can. I know that there were quite a number of people who actually work there that live here in our city. Those jobs would be lost. And that we've heard from our constituents that they're very interested. And those in Paso Robles and Templeton also consider this as a regional recycling center that does more than their recycling centers at their grocery stores.
Thank you. Other council questions, comments? Let me open it up to the public if any member of the public wishes to comment on this item. Thank you. We'll bring it back to, and I'll just offer a couple tidbits of history on this, just because, again, we have now as a council taken action that we are asking staff to get back involved. Previously, we had really decided we would not go forward with waste management, and looking at what plan B would be by law. We were fortunate that with this particular recycling center, it is truly the best in the county, and it has been a great service. It has some value regionally. Without its existence, by state law, the grocery stores are mandated to provide a buyback center. There's many complicated rules with Cal Recycling, a state organization that deals with this. That's why we kind of turned it over to Bill Worrell, who's the chief executive officer with the Integrated Waste Management Authority. And we had the opportunity to speak with state-level representatives as part of IWMA, and Rochelle and I and the representatives on another item, and we kind of slipped this in and just alerted them that, you know, we were looking to the grocery stores to help out on that. Lots of catch-22s, but one issue would be, will they be able to step in and help out on a portion? So I think that's one thing staff will be looking at in parallel, and they have the resources of IWMA that, you know, they will be coordinating with. On another note, you know, the owner of the property that is leased to Waste Management has contacted me and just was curious, and I kind of referred him to our city manager. Well, she'd be the best one to let you know where things are going. But one thing that is, I think, encouraging is before he had gotten notice, kind of a cease and desist. We're not going to follow through on the lease in the future. And then recently, I think after the contact, I know Councilman Kelly followed up meeting with staff, our city manager did, and I know that their corporate out of Texas called the property managers as well. Let's take a look at this. So we don't know what that means, but I think at least everyone's kind of back at the table. Everyone's had some time to think about this, and now I think it's time for, you know, staff to see what can be worked out. But there's three at least main players. There's waste management. There's the grocery stores that have some obligation one way or the other. And then there is us, which can look at rate issues and those kinds of things. So I think we're looking forward to what you can pull together there, Ms. City Manager. Councilman Kelly.
Yes, I'll follow up on Mrs. Fonzie's statements. I think it's really, really important that we retain this recycling center. There will be jobs that are lost. It's an economic hit to the city, really. There's almost a little over $800,000 a year that's paid out of that recycling center, mostly to people who are in need. The people that are getting those monies are not buying stocks or putting it in the bank. They're using it to survive, which is sales tax revenue within our city. I know that a handful of people that actually really rely on it. And like Mayor O'Malley said, it's by far the best recycling center, I think, at least in the county. They recycle oil, appliances, and what have you. And if we can't come to terms on this, we will not have that anymore. And I think there's room in there for negotiations. I did meet with the people. I didn't enter into any negotiations or anything. My purpose on that was just to open the doors and hopefully get everybody back to the table and start talking again, I think, which we're doing. And I'd like to recall that within the contract, there's about four different options that are available to try to come to terms to keep the recycling center open. And I think, either one of those options or a combination of two or three that we can make this work. And the main important part is, to make it fair to everybody. I think we've all have accepted that recycling is part of our life right now, and it's going to be more critical down the road. So hopefully, I think staff can sit down and work this out.
Well said. Seeing no other comments, I believe we can adjourn. Thank you.
Mayor O'Malley, I just wanted to ask for purpose of my minutes on the question about the fire truck, the answer that you would like back. Are you expecting that at the next council meeting? Or
I'm leaving that in city manager's discretion. Okay. I don't know what it'll take. We would certainly like it as soon as feasible.
Okay, thanks.